Members of Congress expressed optimism Sunday about the prospects for reaching a deal to avoid the fiscal cliff.
Fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is entering its third full day, and both Israelis and Palestinians.
Bottom line, Senator, if the president nominates Ambassador Rice to be the next Secretary of State or some other.
Supplementary question. Do you personally believe that gay people are born gay?
Impact segment tonight, the Talking Points memo.
Hot damn politics.
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 Hot damn
politics.
Hot diggity damn politics.
Politics.
Hot diggity damn politics.
I'm back now with the Brain Trust panel.
Brain Trust.
Brain Trust.
Brain Trust.
Brain Trust panel.
Hot diggity damn politics.
I put that shit on everybody.
People moving in love because of the color of the skin.
Run, 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 run like you something.
And I bought out a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love, my brother, is the preacher. And it seems nobody is interested in learning but the teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, diminution, obligation to my nation. Revolution, gun control, the sound of folk. Shooting rockets to the moon, kids going up to zoom. Politicians say more taxes will solve everything.
And the band played on.
Rising past the Beatles, new records of gas.
And the only safe place to live is on an Indian reservation. And the band played on.
Eve of destruction, tax deduction,
fear sector, bill collectors, all corrupt in the male population. Suicide, too many bills, hippies moving to the hills. People all over the world are shouting in the war. And the band played on.
Yeah.
jump on my train when I'm out of sight. Just check yourself and say, yeah, you're right.
Good. Everybody ready? Yeah. We need to get his fucking drummer song. Can we get his fucking drummer song? Can we get his fucking drummer song?
Give him a damn beat.
That drummer.
Hit that bass.
Get up, get on up, stay on the scene, get on up, like a sex machine.
machine. Get on up, get up, get on up, get up, get on up. Bobby, can I take him to the bridge?
Go ahead,
take him on to the bridge.
Take him to the bridge.
Can I take him to the bridge?
Yeah.
Take him to the bridge.
Yeah.
Hit me now. Come on now. Stay on the scene. I like a tight machine. Stay on the scene like a loving machine. Stay on the scene like a loving machine. Stay on the scene. I want to count it off one more time. Now.
Go ahead.
You want to hear it like it did on the top, fellas? Hear it like it did on the top. Hear it now. Get on up.
Get on up.
Get up. Machine,
get on up,
get up,
get on up,
taste,
get on up,
a piano,
get on up,
taste,
get on up,
a piano,
get on up.
Get up,
get on up.
Look at the air. Look at the hang time.
People always debated, who's the greatest player of all time? Dumb question. It should be, who's the greatest team of all time?
WGAG Radio.
Sorry, Showtime.
WGAG Radio.
Back to back.
WGAG Radio.
First three-peat.
WGAG Radio.
Even with the flu.
WGAG Radio.
No push-off.
WGAG Radio.
And my favorite. Tough to beat that. What? You think there's someone else? Prove it.
Look at the air. Look at the hang.
All Eyes on Egypt presents The Holy Tablet, backed by popular demand. Written and transcribed by Dr. Malachi Zodok Yoel, the receiver. This is the scripture that is divinely inspired that will bring about a long overdue change. Like the phoenix bird rising up out of its ashes. Up, you mighty people, come forth like Lazarus from the tomb. This tablet is food to feed the hunger and to nourish the soul, to give it strength. Rise up, stand up, be counted amongst the people of this world. Be the first to get your copy of the Holy Tablets while supplies last. At All Eyes on Egypt, Monticello, Georgia, 706-468-2319.
Moringa. Oh, moringa. Oh,
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 yeah.
Oh, I know you want the best.
Yeah.
I know you want the best in the octagon. Pure protein, superfood on the planet. Oh yeah. Oh, give me antioxidants. Oh, oh, protein, baby. Oh, yeah. Moringa. Oh.
You want the best antioxidants, pure protein, superfood on the planet? Let Greener Greens supply you with their raw, organic moringa. Moringa is a super immune booster, providing a powerhouse of minerals and amino acids. Visit Greener Greens on the World Wide Web at www.greener-greens.com and place your order of moringa today. Available in 8 and 16 ounces, along with their many other organic superfoods. Call Greener Greens at 510-479-6406 and place your order of moringa today. Remember, the greener the leaner, Greener Greens.
Members of Congress expressed optimism Sunday about the prospects for reaching a deal to avoid the fiscal cliff.
A fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is entering its third full day, and both Israelis and Palestinians.
Bottom line, Senator, if the president nominates Ambassador Rice to be the next Secretary of State or some other...
Supplementary question. Do you personally believe that gay people are born gay?
Impact segment tonight, the Talking Points memo...
Hot damn politics.
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 Hot diggity damn politics.
Politics.
Hot diggity damn politics.
I'm back now with the Brain Trust panel.
Brain Trust. Brain Trust. Brain Trust. Brain Trust panel.
These niggas won't hold me back.
These niggas won't hold me back. These niggas won't hold me back. These niggas won't hold me back. These niggas won't hold me back.
The Brain Trust Panel.
Brain Trust, Brain Trust, Brain Trust, Brain Trust Panel.
Hot diggity damn politics.
I put that shit on everything.
Hot damn politics. Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Only on WGAG Radio.
Please welcome the Brain Trust. The Brain Trust. Please welcome the Brain Trust, the Brain Trust. Welcome the Brain Trust, the Brain Trust. The Brain Trust, the Brain Trust. Brain Trust.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? You know what it is. It's Hot Damn Politics Wednesday night. Yes, it's the reading of yeah, Godfather. That's what it is. Read and orated in Radio Vision style by the one and only Donna Colleon. She'll be here in a minute, you know what I'm saying, to get things popping off. But I want to say what's up to everybody that's in attendance tonight. Yes, indeed, for the epic moment. I call it Radio Vision. That's what it is. That's what WGAG brings you. So definitely want to say what's up to the one and only Bella Soul, a.k.a. La Bella Vita, Beast Mode, White House correspondent, and all those damn things. And in between, shout out to you, Queen Vita. How you doing? Yes, yes. And the one and only Donna Colleon is WGAG herself. You know what it is. You make sure you go ahead and download today's show. It was a great show. Make sure you download that and put it on your cell phones and all your devices that you got and what you listen to the greatest show on the planet on. So go ahead and do that. If you don't, you bullshitting. You ain't about that life, as they say around these parts. All right, we'll set up to Chalice 42. What's going on with your Chalice? The soul, all these souls, I'm fucking up. The soul of Iwana. What's going on, Iwana? Rahu back. What's going on with you now? Dorian Barnes is in the building. G.A. from P.A. is kicking it with us tonight. He's been waiting for this. I've been seeing him all week. Where's the show? G.A. from P.A. He's been waiting on this one. All right. Mama Get Real is definitely in the building. The guest that's in here live, Antanas, a.k.a. Born Sue, is in the building. The Math M.D. Miss Sip is kicking it with us tonight always. Rab Jones is in the building. Y'all, I see myself. I give kisses to myself. Teresa Washington is in the building. And Universe Soul is in the building over here kicking it with us tonight. Let me peek my head over in the Donna Colleon after party. Where's interactive chat room open 365, 24 hours a day. None of your business is over there kicking in with us, too. Iwana's at the two places at the same damn time. Iwana 98 is over there. Nick Nubian's kicking in over there in the chat room. Chameen is over there. Charm 999. Palm Talk. I don't even know what that means. Palm Talk? I'm not even going to. My mind's not in the right place to think about what palm talk means. But nonetheless, Vortex Surfer's over there kicking it. What's going on with your Vortex self-guided jams world? Jania's in the building. WRJ11, she called over here. And Mushmouth is streaming into her own damn after parties, the one and only Donna Colleon. So no further ado, let's get in the host of Hot Damn Politics. You all know her. Fireliners Rock. Come on in here, Fireliners. I was about to come up with something else, but it was going to come out all wrong. So just come on out here, Fireliners.
Mic check, Neff.
Mic check, how you doing this evening? How are you?
I am great, and how are you and the family?
We're all great, man. Yep. Living, kicking it, you know how it go. Yeah, we're good. Sorry, that was like a gnat. I hate gnats. Sorry. That was a gnat clap. You know, gnat clap. I'm trying to get a gnat. That was a gnat clap. How's everybody over there on the south side?
Chilly. We've experienced, instead of summer, we've experienced a very long fall.
Wow, okay. Oh, man.
So
chilly.
It's like 72 degrees. It gets down to the 50s at night. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it is what it is. But
right. The Chi-Town living, we know.
Yeah. No, this is totally unusual. We should be in the 90s.
Right. August,
yeah.
And everything. August is around the corner. It should be nice and humid, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're just happy it's not snowing.
I know. Right. Don't snow in that bitch. That's right. Take 72
right.
Over snow any day. So
yeah.
I know you wanted to get into the hot and breaking news, everything that's going on in the world of politics before we get the great reading started. So take it away.
So we're going to be honored with Don doing our reading. That's my special
that's
request.
Right. That's right.
But here's how we're going to do it because, you know, I've had a few people call me and
mm-hmm.
ask me, what the hell has the Godfather got to do with politics? Why Why are you diverting?
Right.
And besides, you know, the thing that I told them, this is my one of my favorite books, and I want to. It's also a lot of lessons that can be learned by the Godfather. The Godfather is very important to me.
Very.
And so I've always said that I thought everybody should read the book in order to get the underlying reasons why people did what they did, because, of course, you know, you cannot put all that on the screen. So a lot
right.
of things happen on the screen that you don't know the backstories to, which is why I said everybody should read the book. So I'm just pleased that you requested it, because...
Can you say that again one more time, Firelines? Can you just pat me on the back one more time? Can you just do that
I'm going to give you all the credit, Neff, because this was a special request that Neff made, that we should read The Godfather.
That's right. You missed it. You totally missed that one, Don. I requested it, like, when you were talking about it. I was like, this would be a great read.
Yeah,
Mario Puzo would be a great read.
Neff said, why don't we do it in Hot Damn Politics? And so I said, great, fine, because, Don, we talked about this like a year ago after we did 1984, but I was waiting until the summer was over, and I was seriously leaning towards reading the print, and I just kept putting it off in my mind, because the prints is really technical and dry. If you remember, we tried to do it in, I think, Pal Talk. I tried to read the prints in Pal Talk, and Don just was bored stiff. So, in the after party.
Yes.
So, I was trying to think of another one, and I was kind of leaning towards Animal Farm, because that is also a very good read. But let's just do The Godfather, make everybody happy, because we all know the movie.
Right.
You know, and when we do these quotes, when Don says, you're out, Tom, everybody understand what the fuck that means.
Right.
You know, we're gonna do it, and all the people who are not on in the chat, not in the after party, who are just listening in the archives and listening on the phone, you know, I know you're not going to be able to read along, but believe me, if you listen to 1984, Don makes the reading come alive, so you'll be able to get the whole gist of
That's
everything
right.
we read. It's going to be great.
Radio vision.
Yes.
She's going to bring the vision to the radio.
As now, as usual, as we did in 1984, in the beginning of the shows, even though we're going to do the reading, I still need to give you a little bit of what I'm going to just randomly pick, the biggest stories politically.
Okay.
Because we do need to try to keep up to date. And so now let me just say, we talked about this a couple weeks ago now, the lawsuit that John Boehner was threatening.
Right, yes.
Okay.
We're keeping you niggas abreast. Why do you call it abreast? I was just wondering, but go ahead.
Maybe because white men like to kiss each other and they have to get... So here's the deal. Congress is going on a 5-week hiatus. They're breaking what they call the congressional break, starting on Friday.
Okay.
They will be gone for 5 weeks. So before they left, they wanted to jab Obama before they left.
That's a long-ass vacation, 5 weeks.
Yeah, they do this, and they do it again at Christmas, and they do it again. They do, like, 3 times a year. They take breaks. So they are mandated by the president in case of an emergency to, he can summon them to come back to D.C. So that's within his presidential power. He can break that 5 weeks at any time. I know, I'm trying to think of who else did it, but right off the top of my head, Harry Truman did it when he was president, and he had a what he called a do-nothing Congress, and they went off on a break, and he called them back into session.
I would have been doing the same thing. I was like, if I was president, I'd be like, you motherfuckers ain't did nothing. Get right back here.
Right.
See you like 3 days, and that's it.
If I were Obama, I would do that to them based on what they did today. I would let them all go home, let them schedule their town hall meetings, and then tell them they had to be back on Monday.
Exactly. You motherfuckers get a 3-day weekend back here on Monday.
Yes, based on the fact that this 113th Congress has passed less congressional bills than any Congress in the history of the United States. Truman's do-nothing Congress passed 900 laws. This Congress has passed less than 250.
Well, he talked about milking the system. Ooh, he's collecting them checks. They ain't doing nothing.
They're doing nothing. But they did manage to get together today to pass this resolution. This is what it's called until it goes to the Senate where it is confirmed. It is called a resolution. And in this resolution, the vote came out. Let me see if I can give you the vote. 225 to 201. 225 to 201, and 5 Republicans voted nay with the Democrats. The Democrats unanimously voted no. 5 Republicans crossed the line, and those 5 Republicans were Paul Breuer of Maryland, Scott Garrett of New Jersey, Thomas Massie of Kentucky, Steve Stockman of Texas, and Walter Jones of North Carolina. Now, it's a little, it's interesting that they had a Republican from New Jersey, Kentucky, Texas, and North Carolina all to vote nay with the Democrats, considering that some of those states are highly
red.
So they're voting truly their conscience, or they're either up for election in 2014, and they're having really close races with the Democrats.
Right. I can see that.
So,
could
be that they decided they did not want to piss off the Democrats in their districts to overwhelmingly come out to vote against them if they had voted yay along with the Republicans. This is the basis of the lawsuit. Okay? Part of Obamacare stated that the corporations or business, small business, would have to roll in Obamacare in 2014. If you remember a year ago, the Republicans were protesting greatly that the small businessmen could not afford to do that, and so that they needed an extension. They didn't need to roll it in until 2015 in order for them to be able to financially be able to roll their employees into Obamacare. That was the stance of the Republicans.
Right.
So Obama said, okay, I will give them a 1-year extension. They will not have to implement it until 2015. That's what the Republicans are suing him on, that he didn't make the small business owners implement Obamacare in 2014. But in fact, it was them who said they couldn't get, he shouldn't do it.
So now they're suing him on that basis.
Yeah, now they're suing him on the fact that he didn't make the small business owners implement Obamacare to their employees. I mean, you almost have to go, what? You know, it's like the cartoon where you go,
right, right.
And now you're going to sue me because I acquiesced to your request?
Just want to put on the show. Got to put on the show. If you can't bring up impeachment, the next best thing is a lawsuit. So got to go for whatever. Whatever's hanging low from the fruit tree, pick it. Literally.
So Boehner is saying that he's going to sue over the decision to delay for a year a central health care requirement for businesses to provide health care. The House voted after he made the acquisition, after he acquiesced, the House then voted to go along with the request. So they forced him into it, and then they ratified it.
Ratification means they basically signed, sealed, and delivered it, folks.
That's correct.
Right.
Now they're coming back a year later and saying, you didn't do it. But you voted not to. You voted for the year extension. How schizophrenic are you people?
It ain't even that they schizophrenic. It's just that the people who listen to them and follow them are like deaf, dumb, and blind. So they're like, yeah. It's like they're going to rule anyway. They're not going to pay attention to the details at all.
That's correct. That's why I'm telling you niggas the details. because most people are not aware of the fact that if, in fact, I'd almost say they set a perfect trap for him, but I don't think they're that fucking smart. I think after they did it, after they protested and he acquiesced, and then they voted it in, they said, they looked around and said, what can we do? Oh, the American public is stupid. They'll forget that this was our idea. We'll protest the idea that
I mean, come on, Fire.
Nobody will even know we are the ones behind the shit that he even said he would back off and do.
Think about this. They stupid enough to know that Obamacare is Romneycare. If they couldn't figure that out, you know they're not going to figure this out.
Yeah, because they never will address that it was originally Romney's proposal, his plan. So the way that this is going to roll here is the Office of the General Counsel, so they're literally taking their attorney. The House of Representatives has a law consultant called the Office of General Counsel, who is supposed to be able to tell them legally where they stand on different bills that they propose, okay? So this guy now, who is the head of the Office of the General Counsel, will have to represent the House in court. Now, I haven't done the research on this yet as to whether that person is partisan and you get a different Office of the General Counsel based on the party that is belongs to the Speaker of the House. So I don't know whether this is a Republican who's sitting in that seat and Pelosi had a Democrat sitting in that seat, or because a lot of times in the federal government, these are civil service jobs for who are not affiliated with a political party per se. The general counsel, general inspector, the GI, the general inspector of each different department is supposed to be a career position. So
got it. Not a political office.
A person
right.
who's not affiliated with a party. So I need to find out if the office of the general counsel is partisan or if it is a career position. If it's a career position, they're putting this particular person who's the general counsel, he is going to have to go in, whether he believes in this bill, in this resolution, this lawsuit or not, and defend it. Now, because they're suing Obama, the burden of proof that the House of Representatives has been damaged, because this is a civil suit, so they have to prove that somehow Obama not making these small businessmen implement Obamacare in 2014 damaged the House of Representatives.
This is interesting. See, you said it's a civil suit. So basically it comes down to it's like symbolic and it's money. So if he found guilty, what do you got to pay, like $1 trillion to the brand? I mean, what are they going to get out of it? That's why it's a show, because you're not going to get nothing out of it. It's like, if it's a civil suit, it's usually that's money. That's some monetary damages you're suing for.
We have to see the wording of the lawsuit in order for us to see what the damages that they're asking. They could ask, because you know you can't ask for a dollar.
Right.
It is it could be that they simply want to, because everything that happens is for, and I always mess up on this word, perpetuity. This is a historical event, okay? Let me say it so in another way. It's a historical event so that forever and ever it will be, if this lawsuit is accepted by a court, because a court doesn't have to accept your lawsuit, if this lawsuit is accepted by a court and it is in fact a trial, that will be in perpetuity for Barack Obama. So anytime anybody looks up his record as President of the United States, that will show up as the first time that Congress took a president to a legal court, sued a president. So
they're going to look at it.
They're
going to look and say, President Obama, oh, you ain't shit. You got sued. Like that.
What you understand what I'm saying? More than anything else, Neff, this is a means of discrediting him. This is their way of tainting his presidency. Just like to bring an impeachment would be a taint on your president. Anything that has to do with your record, when you talk about Lyndon Johnson, the first thing that comes to people's mind is any of the good shit that he did, but the first thing that comes to your mind is he started the Vietnam War. Anytime that you talk about Richard Nixon, the first thing that comes to your mind is,
I'm not a crook, Watergate.
He had to resign from office.
Right.
Anytime you think about Ronald Reagan, the first thing that comes to people's mind is the Iran-Contra. So the usually talk about is the negative shit. Before you look at, yes, but Lyndon Johnson did all this good stuff. Richard Nixon did all this good stuff. you know, Ronald Reagan did all this good stuff. You think about the negative things first. And so this will be something that would be on his record forever, that he was sued by the House of Representatives. And so that's why they're doing it. They're not doing it because they want $10 million.
Right.
They're not doing
right.
it because they want to make him make employers do Obamacare. They're doing it to smudge his name and his legacy as a president.
He's doing a pretty good job on his own, but yes, you're right.
Perpetuity. Thank you, Dawn. Okay, so I wanted to go through that, and also, just so that you know, just to show a little bit more crazy going on in Washington, D.C., Tuesday, the House of Representatives released their proposal to bring forth a bill to respond to the child migrant crisis.
All my Central American cousins that's trying to get over here?
Right.
Okay.
They were proposing on bringing this up for a vote tomorrow, Thursday. And then their goal was to pressure the Senate and the White House into accepting it, which we know they wouldn't. But Ted Cruz over in the Senate, who has nothing fucking to do with the House of Representatives, Ted Cruz is a senator, is trying to shoot down the Republican proposal.
Why? He's a Mexican. No, I'm sorry. Feel
okay.
No bad. He felt a little something in the inside.
And you know, this is not the first time that he's went over to the House to have meetings with congressmen in order to override John Boehner. So
he about to be the leader of that new party. He just going there to look, man. He's like, I've been trained by Harry Kissinger and all these motherfuckers. Y'all fucking up. Like, this is stupid. They like, don't do it. You're fucking it up for later down the road.
I think he was being ignored, and so he's trying to find something to make himself relevant. You know, the last thing that a politician wants is to be invisible. They have to. They constantly want to be their face to be on the news.
Right.
For them to be in the newspaper, so he's almost creating events for himself.
You have to be seen as someone who has influence, political influence.
Correct. Otherwise, he becomes just another one in Washington, D.C., and if you're trying to build a reputation for yourself, and literally he's going head-to-head with the Speaker of the House, it can be one of two things. If he can pull it off, then he will definitely become a power broker. But if he can't, if John Boehner actually puts him down because of the power of the Speaker of the House in controlling his members, which is what he has lacked any backbone to do up until today. He's one of the weakest speakers of the House that I've seen in a long time. He needs to shut Ted Cruz down. You can't have a senator coming over threatening the Speaker of the House. This is supposed to be a united thing. The Speaker of the House is supposed to be united with McConnell over in the Senate. And that's who he's supposed to be talking to. He's not supposed to be bulldozed by a freshman member.
Nobody respects him. He spends too much time in the sun. He's not an authentic cracker.
You know, you just got here. Well, he is. He's an authentic now because he gave up his Canadian citizenship.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So he's obviously making moves. So I just wanted to bring that up, too. So you've got, we'll see what happens tomorrow when this vote comes up for the Republicans' answer to this immigration problem. Okay? So that's
all
basically,
right.
That's it. We really want to get into the Godfather.
That's
so,
right.
Don, are you on?
We gotta bring her in properly. We gotta bring in the one and only Donna Colleone.
Okay.
In properly.
You do that now.
Drum roll, please. You've seen her for the past 5 years on WGAG Radio. She has brought you everything. Like, can we all agree that we all been mind fucked and tricked? She has told you niggas about right knowledge and everything in between. It's the one, the only, who can bring it to you radio vision style. It's Miss WGAG herself. It's Don Colleone. Come on in here, Don.
Yeah.
What's going on, Godfather?
What up?
What up? Do, 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 You got it, though, Don. What's going on?
Hey, what up?
Whoa!
Hey,
Don! How
yeah.
you doing, Don?
Good. How you?
I'm doing good.
Okay.
You ready to get this thing popping?
Yeah, man. Let's go and get that shit going, man.
You all right? Let's go!
But I'm good. Oh, you just want me to jump right on into that shit then, huh? just throw me out there like that, right? We ain't gonna say a prayer or something?
No, that would be you.
Okay. Doc, you called in already, nigga. This nigga call in. Doc hanging around, man. You know what I'm talking about? So, shit, you know, I had to put on my good wife outfit in front of you. Hey, like I'm fucking good and shit. Goddamn. Like I ain't kill a pit bull today. You feel me? You good? All right. So, where's Queen Vida? Everybody, anybody need the book? Y'all need to holler at Bella Soul in the chat room. You need to private message her for the book. Y'all ready?
Ready.
Yes, ma'am.
Damn, y'all niggas suck, man. The Godfather, goddamn, by Holy Mario shit. Puzo. Chapter 1, Book 1. Behind every great fortune, there is a crime. Balzac. Neff, can I get the Godfather song for real quick, please?
Yes. Boo, 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 doo, 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 doo.
Shut the fuck up.
Do 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 do
do do do do do do do do do do do do do do do do do do do Bonacera sat in New York Criminal Court Number 3 and waited for justice, vengeance on the men who had so cruelly hurt his daughter, who had tried to dishonor her. The judge, a formidably heavy-featured man, rolled up the sleeves of his black robe as if to physically chastise the two young men standing before the bench. His face was cold, with majestic contempt. But there was something false in all this that Amerigo Bonacera sensed, but did not yet understand. You acted like the worst kind of degenerate crackers, the judge said harshly. Yes, yes, thought Amerigo Bonacera. Animals, animals. The two young men, glossy hair, crew cut, scrubbed, clean-cut faces, composed in humble contrition, bowed their heads in submission. The judge went on. You acted like wild beasts in a jungle, and you are fortunate you did not sexually molest that poor girl, or I'll put your ass behind bars for 20 years. The judge paused. His eyes beneath impressively thick brows flickered slyly toward the sallow face Amerigo Bonacera, then lowered to a stack of probation reports before him. He frowned and shrugged as if convinced against his own natural desire. He spoke again. But because of your youth, your clean records, because of your fine families, and because the law in its majesty does not seek vengeance, I hereby sentence you to 3 years confinement to the penitentiary. Sentence to be suspended. Only 40 years of professional mourning kept the overwhelming frustration and hatred from showing on Amerigo Bonacera's face. His beautiful young daughter was still in the hospital with her broken jaw wired together. And now these two animals went free. It had all been a farce. He watched the happy parents cluster around their darling sons. Oh, they were all happy now. They were smiling now. The black bile, sourly bitter, rose in Bonacera's throat, overflowed through tightly clenched teeth. He used his white linen pocket handkerchief and held it against his lips. He was standing so when the two young men strolled freely up the aisle, confident and cool-eyed, smiling, not giving him so much as a glance. He let them pass without saying a word, pressing the fresh linen against his mouth. The parents of the animals were coming by now, two men and two women, his age, but more American in their dress. They glanced at him, shamefaced, yet in their eyes was an odd, triumphant defiance. Out of control, Bonacera leaned forward toward the aisle and shouted hoarsely, "You will weep as I have wept. I will make you weep as your children make me weep." The linen at his eyes now. The defense attorneys bringing up the rear swept their clients forward in a tight little band, enveloping the two young men who had started back down the aisles as if to protect their parents. A huge bailiff moved quickly to block the row in which Bonacera stood, but it was not necessary. All his years in America, Amerigo Bonacera had trusted in law and order, and he had prospered thereby. Now, though his brain smoked with hatred, though wild visions of buying a gun and killing the two men jangled the very bones of his skull, Bonacera turned to his still uncomprehending wife and explained to her, "They have made fools of us." He paused and then made his decision, no longer fearing the cost. For justice, we must go on our knees to Don Corleone. Song, Neff. Song, Neff.
Okay, we got to get the goddamn song.
I got the song. I just didn't feel like playing the shit. Okay, I have everything ready next week. I have everything. We got Neff is doing powerful though. Neff is perfect.
Is good.
Yeah, Neff, you're doing real good.
Okay, so now
we really see that this Undertaker had actually went to the law. He came to America. He was an immigrant who came here, who, as it says, he really had trusted in law and order. He bought the American bullshit stock, lock, and barrel. Okay? Because coming from Sicily, he knew that when you had a problem, you went to your Don. And your Don took care of your problem. He got you justice. But here, when he came to this world, he was told that there's justice for everybody. And he believed it, and he actually was devastated when he found out that white Anglo-Saxon Protestants would always trump an immigrant.
That's right. You ready?
Yes.
In a garishly decorated Los Angeles hotel suite, Johnny Fontaine was a jealous drunk as an ordinary husband. Sprawled on a red couch, he drank straight from the bottle of scotch in his hand, then washed the taste away by drunking his mouth in a crystal bucket of ice cubes and water. It was 4 a.m. and he was spinning drunken fantasies of murdering his trampy wife when she got home. If she ever did come home, it was too late to call his first wife and ask about the kids, and he felt funny about calling any of his friends now that his career was plunging downhill. There had to have been a time when they would have been delighted, flattered by his calling them at 4 a.m, but now he bored them. He could even smile a little to himself as he thought that on the way up, Johnny Fontaine's troubles had fascinated some of the greatest female stars in America. Gulping at his bottle of scotch, he heard finally his wife's key in the door, but he kept drinking until she walked into the room and stood before him. She was to him so very beautiful, the angelic face, soulful violet eyes, the delicately fragile but perfectly formed body. On the screen, her beauty was magnified, spiritualized. 100 million men all over the world were in love with the face of Margaret Ashton and paid to see it on the screen. Where the hell were you? Johnny Fontaine asked. Out fucking, she said. She had misjudged his drunkenness. He sprang over the cocktail table and grabbed her by the goddamn throat. But close up to that magical face, the lovely violet eyes, he lost his anger and became helpless again. She made the mistake of smiling mockingly, saw his fist draw back. She screamed, Johnny, not in the face, I'm making a picture. She was laughing. He punched her in the stomach, and she fell to the floor. He fell on top of her. He could smell her fragrant breath as she gasped for air. He punched her on the arms and on the thigh muscles of her silky tan legs. He beat her as he had beaten snotty smaller kids long ago, when he had been a tough teenager in New York's Hell Kitchen. A painful punishment that would leave no lasting disfigurement of loosened teeth or broken nose. But he was not hitting her hard enough. He couldn't. And she was giggling at him, spread eagle on the floor. Her brocaded gown hitched up above her thighs. She taunted him between giggles. Come on. Stick it in. Stick it in, Johnny. That's what you really want. Johnny Fontaine got up. He hated the woman on the floor, but her beauty was magic shield. Margaret rolled away, and in a dance of spring was on her feet facing him. She went into a childish mocking dance and chanted, Johnny never hurt me. Johnny never hurt me. Then almost sadly, with a grave beauty, she said, you poor silly bastard. giving me cramps like a kid. Ha, Johnny, you always will be a dumb romantic guinea. You even make love like a kid. You still think screwing is really like those dopey songs you used to sing. She shook her head and said, poor Johnny. Goodbye. Goodbye, Johnny. She walked into the bedroom, and he heard her turn the key in the lock. Johnny sat on the floor with his face in his hands. The sick, humiliating despair overwhelmed him. And then the gutter toughness that had helped him survive the jungle of Hollywood made him pick up the phone and call for a car to take him to the airport. There was one person who could save him. He would go back to New York. He would go back to the one. He would go back to the one man with the power, the wisdom he needed, and a love he still trusted, his godfather, Corleone. Now.
Dun, 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 dun. Stop making me laugh. Dun, dun, dun.
I got to remix The Godfather. I'm going to remix that shit. I'm working on it this weekend, Fireliner. We're going to have a goddamn hip-hop Godfather mix.
Okay. I just want to say that's Frank Sinatra and Ava Gardner.
Yeah.
Bam. Neff out.
Yeah, that's quick, wasn't it, Neff? Sorry, Neff. Okay, no, not really. You're not out. Trust me. You're perfect.
That's
shall
what
we continue?
Saying. He left his wife and all them kids for her, and she despised him because he was weak.
And she laughed.
Talk bad about his fucking and everything.
Yeah,
man.
Boy.
Talk about a gut shot.
I guess sometimes they fall for their own publicity.
Shall we write?
Hold on.
All right. I know this is my bedtime. This is why I lay in the bed and let Doc play with my nipples now. Shit. I listen to Hot Damn Politics. And eat cookies.
All right.
Okay. The baker. Nazarene, pudgy and crusty as his great Italian loaves, still dusty with flour, scowled at his wife, his nubile daughter, Catherine, and his baker's helper, Enzo. I'm Enzo, the baker! Okay, I'm sorry. Enzo had changed into his prisoner of war uniform with his green letter. If it's your father, I stay. If there's trouble, I stay. No, that's a bad part right now. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm waking up, Dr. Tan, off the pity. I'm up now.
Okay.
Waking up. My bad. Sorry. Had a flashback. Enzo had changed into his prisoner of war uniform with his green lettered armband and was terrified that this scene would make him late reporting back to the governor's island. One of the many thousands of Italian army prisoners paroled daily to work in the American economy, he lived in constant fear of that parole being revoked. And so the little comedy being played now was, for him, a serious business. Nazarene asks fiercely, have you dishonored my family? Have you given my daughter a little package to remember you by now that the war is over? And you know America will kick your ass back to your village full of shit in Sicily. Enzo, a very short, strongly built boy, put his hand over his heart and said, almost in tears, yet cleverly, Padrone, I swear by the Holy Virgin, I have never taken advantage of your kindness. I love your daughter with all respect, and I ask her for her hand, and I ask for her hand with all respect. And I know I have no right, but if they send me back to Italy, I can never come back to America. I will never be able to marry Catherine. Nazarene's wife, Philomena, spoke to the point. stop all this foolishness, she said to her pudgy husband. You know what we must do. Keep Enzo here. Send him to hide with our cousins in Long Island. Catherine was weeping. She was already plump, homely, and sprouting a faint mustache. She would never get a husband as handsome as Enzo, never find another man who touch her body in secret places with such respectful love. I'll go and live in Italy, she screamed at her father. I'll run away if you don't keep Enzo here. Nazarene glanced at her shrewdly. She was a hot number, this daughter of his. He had seen her brush her swelling buttocks against Enzo's front when the baker's helper squeezed behind her to fill the counter baskets with hot loaves from the oven. The young rascal's hot loaf would be in her oven, Nazarene thought lewdly, if proper steps were not taken. Enzo must be kept in America and be made an American citizen. And there was only one man who could arrange such an affair. The Godfather, Don Corleone. Neff. All of these people and many others received engraved invitations to the wedding of Miss Constanza Corleone to be celebrated on the last Saturday in August 1945. The father of the bride, Don Vito Corleone, never forget his old friends and neighbors, though he himself now live in a huge house on Long Island. The reception would be held in that house, and the festivities would go on all day. There was no doubt it would be a momentous occasion. The war with the Japanese had just ended, so there would not be any nagging fear for their sons fighting in the army to cloud these festivities. A wedding was just what people needed to show their joy. And so on that Saturday morning, the friends of Don Corleone streamed out of New York City to do him honor. They bore cream-colored envelopes stuffed with cash as bridal gifts, no checks. Inside each envelope, a card established the identity of the giver and the measure of his respect for the Godfather, a respect truly earned. Don Vito Corleone was a man to whom everybody came for help, and never were they disappointed. He made no empty promises, nor the craven excuse that his hands were tied by more powerful forces in the world than himself. It was not necessary that he be your friend. It was not even important that you had no means with which to repay him. Only one thing was required, that you yourself, proclaim your friendship. And then no matter how poor or powerless the supplicant, Don Corleone would take the man's troubles to his heart, and he would let nothing stand in the way to a solution of that man's woe. His reward? Friendship. The respectful title of Don. And sometimes the more affectionate salutation of Godfather. And perhaps, to show respect only, never for profit, some humble gift, a gallon of homemade wine or a basket of peppered tyrels, specially baked, to grace his Christmas table. It was understood. It was mere good manners to proclaim that you were in his debt and that he had the right to call upon you at any time to redeem your debt by some small service. Now, on this great day, his daughter's wedding day, Don Vito Corleone stood in the doorway of his Long Beach home to greet his guests, all of them known, all of them trusted. Many of them owed their good fortune in life to the Don, and on this intimate occasion felt free to call him Godfather to his face. Even the people performing festal services were his friends. Even the people performing feastal services were his friends. The bartender was an old comrade whose gift was all the wedding liquors and his own expert skills. The waiters were the friends of Don Corleone's sons. The food on the garden picnic tables had been cooked by the Don's wife and her friends, and the gaily festooned one-acre garden itself had been decorated by the young girls, charms of the bride. All in-house motherfuckers, no outside.
Let's put that shit on record.
That's right.
That's how you get that shit done. You don't ask for money. You don't take donations.
That's
you
right.
You don't get on YouTube. You don't beg for shit. You see that shit?
You don't get on YouTube.
Five, I said, no EBT card. Go ahead, newbie. Don Corleone received everyone, rich and poor, powerful and humble, with an equal show of love. He slighted no one. That was his character. And the guests so exclaimed at how well he looked in his tux that an inexperienced observer might easily have thought the Don himself was the lucky groom. Standing at the door with him were two of his three sons, the eldest, baptized Santino, but called Sonny by everyone except his father, was looked at
askance.
Oh, that is the word. I thought that was a typo. Were looked at askance by the older Italian men, with admiration by the younger. Sonny Corleone was tall for a first-generation American of Italian parentage, almost 6 feet, and his crop of bushy, curly hair made him look even taller. His face was that of a gross Cupid. The features, even, but the bowl-shaped lips, thickly sensual. The dimple-cleft chin, in some curious way, obscene. He was built as a powerful as a bull. And it was common knowledge that he was so generously endowed by nature that his martyred wife feared the marriage bed as unbelievers once feared the rack. It was whispered that when as a youth he had visited houses of ill fame, even the most hardened and fearless Putin, after an awed inspection of his massive organ, demanded double price. Here at the wedding feast, some young matrons, wide-hipped, wide-mouthed, measured Sonny Corleone with coolly confident eyes. But on this particular day, they were wasting their time. Sonny Corleone, despite the presence of his wife and three small children, had plans for his sister's maid of honor, Lucy Mancini. This young girl, fully aware, sat at a garden table in her pink formal gown, a tiara of flowers in her glossy black hair. She had flirted with Sonny in the past week of rehearsals and squeezed his hand that morning at the altar. A maiden could do no more. She did not care that he would never be the great man his father had proved to be. Sonny Corleone had strength. He had courage. He was generous, and his heart was admitted to be as big as his organ. Yet,
organ.
Should we translate now?
Yes,
he was
please.
Tall.
Yeah, big dick.
Mandingo. His heart was big as his organ. Yet he did not have his father's humility, but instead a quick, hot temper that led him into errors of judgment. All right now, though he was a great help in his father's business, there were many who doubted that he would become the heir to it. The second son, Frederico, called Fred or Freddo, was a child every Italian prayed to the saints for. Dutiful, loyal, always at the service of his father, living with his parents at age 30. He was short and burly, not handsome, but with the same Cupid head of the family, the curly helmet of hair over the round face and sensual bow lips, shaped lips. Only in Fred, these lips were not sensual, but granite-like. Inclined to dornness, he was still a crutch to his father, never disputed him, never embarrassed him by scandalous behavior with women. Despite all these virtues, he did not have that personal magnetism, that animal force, so necessary for a leader of men, and he too was not expected to inherit the family business. The third son, Michael Corleone, did not stand with his father and his two brothers, but sat at a table in the most secluded corner of the garden. But even there, he could not escape the attentions of the family friends. Michael Corleone was the youngest son of the Don and the only child who had refused the great man's direction. He did not have the heavy, Cupid-shaped face of the other children, and his jet black hair was straight rather than curly. His skin was a clear olive brown that would have been called beautiful in a girl. He was handsome in a delicate way. Indeed, there had been a time when the Don had worried about his younger... Indeed, there had been a time when the Don had worried about his youngest son's masculinity. A worry that was put to rest when Michael Corleone became 17 years old. Now, this youngest son sat at a table in the extreme corner of the garden to proclaim his chosen alienation from father and family. Beside him sat the American girl everyone had heard about, but whom no one had seen until this day. He had, of course, shown the proper respect and introduced her to everyone at the wedding, including his family. They were not impressed with her. She was too thin. She was too fair. Her face was too sharply intelligent for a woman. Her manner too free for a maiden. Her name, too, was outlandish to their ears. She called herself Kay Adams. If she had told them that her family had settled in America 200 years ago and her name was a common one, they would have shrugged. Every guest noticed that the Don paid no particular attention to his third son. Michael had been his favorite before the war and obviously the chosen heir to run the family business when the proper moment came. He had all the quiet force and intelligence of his great father, the born instinct to act in such a way that men had no recourse but to respect him. But when World War II broke out, Michael Corleone volunteered for the Marine Corps. He defied his father's express command when he did so. Don Corleone had no desire, no intention of letting his youngest son be killed in the service of a power foreign to himself. All right. Doctors had been bribed. Secret arrangements had been made. A great deal of money had been spent to take the proper precautions. But Michael was 21 years of age, and nothing could be done against his own willfulness. He enlisted and fought over the Pacific Ocean. He became a captain and won medals. In 1944, his picture was printed in Life magazine with a photo layout of his deeds. A friend had shown Don Corleone the magazine. His family did not dare. And the Don had grunted disdainfully and said, "He performed miracles for strangers." When Michael Corleone was discharged in 1945 to recover from a disabling wound, he had no idea that his father had arranged his release. He stayed home for a few weeks, then, without consulting anyone, entered Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. And so he left his father's house to return for the wedding of his sister and to show his own future wife to them, the washed-out rag of an American girl. Michael Corleone was amusing Kay Adams by telling her little stories about some of the more colorful wedding guests. He was in turn amused by her finding these people exotic and, as always, charmed by her intense interest in anything new and foreign to her experience. Finally, her attention was caught by a small group of men gathered around a wooden barrel of homemade wine. The men were Amerigo Bonacera, Nazarene the Baker, Anthony Coppola, and Luca Brasi. With her usual alert intelligence, she remarked on the fact that these four men did not seem particularly happy. Michael smiled. "No, they're not," he said. "They're waiting to see my father in private. They have favors to ask him." And indeed, it was easy to see that all four men constantly followed the Don with their eyes. As Don Corleone stood greeting guests, a black Chevrolet sedan came to a stop on the far side of the paved mall. Two men in the front seat pulled notebooks from their jackets and, with no attempt at concealment, jotted down license numbers of the other cars parked around the mall. Sonny turned to his father and said, "Those guys over there must be cops." Don Corleone shrugged. "I don't own the streets. They can do what they please." Sonny, heavy Cupid face, grew red with anger. "Those lousy bastards, they don't respect anything." He left the steps of the house and walked across the mall to where the black sedan was parked. He thrust his face angrily close to the face of the driver, who did not flinch, but flapped open his wallet to show a green identification card. Sonny stepped back without saying a word. He spat so that the spittle hit the back door of the sedan and walked away. He was hoping the driver would get out of the sedan and come after him on the mall, but nothing happened. When he reached the steps, he said to his father, "Those guys are FBI men. They're taking down all the license numbers, snotty bastards." Don Corleone knew who they were. His closest and most intimate friends had been advised to attend the wedding in automobiles not their own. And though he disapproved of his son's foolish display of anger, the tantrum served a purpose. It would convince the interlopers that their presence was unexpected and unprepared for. So Don Corleone himself was not angry. He had long ago learned that society imposes insults that must be borne, comforted by the knowledge that in this world there comes a time when the most humble of men, if he keeps his eyes open, can take his revenge on the most powerful. It was this knowledge that prevented the Don from losing the humility all his friends admired in him. But now in the garden behind the house, a four-piece band began to play. All the guests had arrived. Don Corleone put the intruders out of his mind and led his two sons to the wedding feast. Fucking love this shit. Neff, I'm proud of you.
This is gangster.
There were now hundreds of guests in the huge garden, some dancing on the wooden platform, bedecked with flowers, others sitting at long tables piled high with spicy food and gallon jugs of black homemade wine. The bride, Connie Corleone, sat in splendor at a special raised table with her groom, the maid of honor, bridesmaids, and ushers. It was a rustic setting in the old Italian style. not to the bride's taste, but Connie had consented to a guinea wedding to please her father because she had so displeased him in her choice of a husband.
Okay. Get that. Nobody liked Carla from the jump.
Knew he was a weasel. Could smell a weasel. You could see a weasel a mile away.
Yeah, when it got some low-life motherfucking cracker, some white boy. Yeah, nobody liked that nigga, did he?
No, he was one of the five families. He was a member of the five families from
It shows that in the book? Because it is, okay, you're telling the book. I didn't know that.
Here we go, right here.
I thought it was just some nigga, some outsider like Kay.
No,
they
look
like they could be related.
If you remember, Michael tells him right before he kills him, the only reason we let you in the family was because your family guaranteed the safety of Fredo.
That was Mo Green.
No. His family is one of the Dons in Las Vegas.
Yeah, he told Mo Green that.
But Mo Green guaranteed his safety in Las Vegas, but
the five families,
one of the families in Las Vegas guaranteed Fredo's safety, too.
Yeah.
So that's who Carlo is. So they're telling
you
this was a political marriage
between the families.
Okay? This is a royal marriage between the families.
Straight political on Hot Damn Politics. Political marriages.
Okay, go ahead, Don.
Okay. The groom, Carlo Rizzi, was a half-breed, born a Sicilian father and the North Italian mother, from whom he had inherited his blonde hair and blue eyes. His parents lived in Nevada, and Carlo had left that state because of a little trouble with the law. In New York, he met Sonny Corleone, and so met the sister. Don Corleone, of course, sent trusted friends to Nevada, and they reported that Carlo's police trouble was a youthful indiscretion with a gun, not serious, that could easily be wiped off the books to leave the youth with a clean record. They also came back with detailed information on legal gambling in Nevada, which greatly interested the Don, and which he had been pondering over since. It was part of the Don's greatness that he profited from everything. Connie Corleone was not quite pretty girl. Was a not quite pretty girl. Thin and nervous and certain to become shrewish later in life. But today, transformed by her white bridal gown and eager virginity, she was so radiant as to be almost beautiful. Beneath the wooden table, her hand rested on the muscular thigh of her groom, her cupid bow mouth pouted to give him an airy kiss. She thought him incredibly handsome. Carlo Rizzi had worked in the open desert air while very young, heavy laborer's work. Now he had tremendous forearms and his shoulders bulged the jacket of his tux. He basked in the adoring eyes of his bride and filled her glass with wine. He was elaborately courteous to her, as if they were both actors in a play. But his eyes kept flickering toward the huge silk purse the bride wore on her right shoulder, and which was now stuffed full of money envelopes. How much did it hold? $10,000? $20,000? Carlo Rizzi smiled. It was only the beginning. He had, after all, married into a royal family. They would have to take care of him. In the crowd of guests, a dapper young man with the sleek head of a ferret was also studying the silk purse. From sheer habit, Polly Gatto wondered just how he could go about hijacking that fat pocketbook. The ideal amused him. But he knew it was idle, innocent dreaming, as small children dream of knocking out tanks with pop guns. He watched his boss, fat, middle-aged, Peter Clemenza, whirling young girls around the wooden dance floor in a rustic and lusty tarantella. My name is all in this goddamn book. Clemenza, immensely tall, immensely huge, danced with such skill and abandon, his hard belly lecherously bumping the breast of younger, tinier women, that all the guests were applauding him. Older women grabbed his arm to become the next partner. The younger men respectfully cleared off the floor and clapped their hands in time to the mandolin's wild strumming. When Clemenza finally collapsed in a chair, Polly Gatto brought him a glass of icy black wine and wiped the perspiring, jovial-like brow with his silk handkerchief. Clemenza was blowing like a whale as he gulped down the wine. But instead of thanking Polly, he said curtly, "Never mind being a dance judge. Do your job. Take a walk around the neighborhood and see everything is okay." Polly slid away into the crowd. The band took a refreshment break. A young man named Nino Valenti picked up a discarded mandolin, put his left foot up on a chair, and began to sing a coarse Sicilian love song. Nino Valenti's face was handsome, though bloated by continual drinking, and he was already a little drunk. He rolled his eyes as his tongue caressed. That's the one they killed in the third one, wasn't it? Okay, my bad. Okay, never mind. Let's not have this conversation. You said no, that's the end of that. I remember the guy was like, dude, on stage, a little older, little motherfucker, right? He rolled his eyes as his tongue caressed the obscene lyrics. The women shrieked with glee, and the men shouted the last word of each stanza with the singer. Now, Don Nicolione, notoriously straight-laced in such matters, though his stout wife was screaming joyfully with the others, disappeared tactfully into the house. Seeing this, Sonny Corleone made his way to the bride's table and sat down beside young Lucy Mancini, the maid of honor. They were safe. His wife was in the kitchen putting the last touches on the serving of the wedding cake. Sonny whispered a few words in the young girl's ear, and she rose. Sonny waited a few minutes and then casually followed her, stopping to talk with the guests here and there as he worked his way through the crowd. All eyes followed them. The maid of honor, thoroughly Americanized by 3 years of college, was a ripe girl who already had a reputation. All through the marriage rehearsals, she had flirted with Sonny Corleone in a teasing, joking way she thought was permitted because he was the best man and her wedding partner. Now, holding her pink gown up off the ground, Lucy Mancini went into the house smiling with false innocence, ran lightly up the stairs to the bathroom. She stayed there for a few moments. When she came out, Sonny Corleone was on the landing above, beckoning her upward. From behind the closed window of Don Corleone's office, a slightly raised corner room, Thomas Hagen watched the wedding party in the festoon garden. The walls behind him were stacked with law books. Hagen was the Don's lawyer and acting concierge or counselor, and as such held the most vital subordinate position in the family business. He and the Don had solved many a knotty problem in this room. And so when he saw the godfather leave the festivities and enter the house, he knew, wedding or no, there would be a little work this day. The Don would be coming to see him. Ben Hagen saw Sonny Corleone whisper in Lucy Mancini's ear in their little comedy as he followed her into the house. Hagen grimaced, debated whether to inform the Don, and decided against it. He went to the desk and picked up a handwritten list of the people who had been granted permission to see Don Corleone privately. When the Don entered the room, Hagen handed him the list. Don Corleone nodded and said, "Leave Bonazzera to the end." Hagen used the French doors and went directly out into the garden to where the supplicants clustered around the barrel of wine. He pointed to the baker, the pudgy Nazarene. Don Corleone greeted the baker with an embrace. They had played together as children in Italy and had grown up in friendship. Every Easter, freshly baked clotted cheese and wheat germ pies, their crust yolked gold, big around as truck wheels, arrived at Don Corleone's home. On Christmas, on family birthdays, rich, creamy pastries proclaimed the Nazarene's respect. And all through the years, lean and fat, Nazarene cheerfully paid his dues to the bakery union, organized by the Don in his salad days. Never asking for a favor in return, except for the chance to buy black market OPA sugar coupons during the war. Now the time had come for the baker to claim his rights as a loyal friend, and Don Corleone looked forward with great pleasure to granting his request. He gave the baker a Di Nobili cigar and a glass of yellow Strega, and put his hand on the man's shoulder to urge him on. That was the mark of the Don's humanity. He knew from bitter experience what courage it took to ask a favor from a fellow man. He knew. Wow. The baker told the story of his daughter and Enzo, a fine Italian lad from Sicily captured by the American army, sent to the United States as a prisoner of war, given parole to help our war effort. A pure, honorable love had sprung up. Oh, he's talking here, right? Yeah, there we go. A fine Italian lad from Sicily, captured by the American army, sent to the United States as a prisoner of war, given parole to help our war effort. A pure and honorable love had sprung up between honest Enzo and his sheltered Catherine. But now that the war was ended, the poor lad would be repatriated to Italy, and Nazarene's daughter would surely die of a broken heart. Only Godfather Corleone could help this afflicted couple. He was their last hope. The Don walked Nazarene up and down the room, his hand on the baker's shoulder, his head nodding with understanding to keep up the man's courage. When the baker had finished, Don Corleone smiled at him and said, "My dear friend, put all your worries aside." He went on to explain very carefully what must be done. The congressman of the district must be petitioned. This is powerful right here. Y'all got to write this down. The congressman of the district must be petitioned. The congressman would propose a special bill that would allow Enzo to become a citizen. The bill would surely pass Congress, a privilege all those rascals extended to each other. Don Corleone explained that this would cost money. The going price was now $2,000. He, Don Corleone, would guarantee performance and accept payment. Did his friend agree? The baker nodded his head vigorously. He did not expect such a great favor for nothing. That was understood. A special act of Congress does not come cheap. Nazarene was almost tearful in his thanks. Don Corleone walked him to the door, assuring him that competent people would be sent to the bakery to arrange all details, complete all necessary documents. The baker embraced him before disappearing into the garden. Hagen smiled at the Don. That's a good investment for Nazarene, a son-in-law and a cheap lifetime helper in his bakery. all for $2,000. Mm. He paused. Who do I get his job to? Don Corleone frowned and thought. What is that word? Patience?
Paisan.
Not to our paisan. Okay, not to our paisan. Give it to the Jew in the next district. Have the home address changed. I think there might be many such cases now the war is over. We should have extra people in Washington that can handle the overflow and not raise the price. Hagen made a note on his pad. Not Congressman Lutico. Try Fisher. The next man Hagen brought in was a very simple case. His name was Anthony Coppola, and he was the son of a man Don Corleone had worked with in the railroad yards in his youth. Coppola needed $500 to open a pizzeria for a deposit on fixtures in the special oven. For reasons not gone into, credit was not available. The Don reached into his pocket and took out a roll of bills. It was not quite enough. He grimaced and said to Tom Hagen, loan me $100. I'll pay you back Monday when I go to the bank. The supplicant protested that $400 would be ample, but Don Corleone patted his shoulder, saying apologetically, this fancy wedding left me a little short of cash. He took the money Hagen extended to him and gave it to Anthony Coppola with his own rolls of bills. Hagen watched the quiet admiration. The Don always thought that when a man was generous, he must show the generosity as personal. How flattering to Anthony Coppola that a man like Don would borrow to loan him money. Not that Coppola did not know that the Don was a millionaire, but how many millionaires let themselves be put to even a small inconvenience by a poor friend? All right.
You see that? You see that? Now you really got to make this pizzeria function,
yeah,
because
yeah, you better.
Got some hour money for you.
Say what? Say it again, Fireliners.
That's even more pressure on Coppola because he really has to make this pizzeria function because the Don has borrowed money for your venture.
That right. Smooth ass nigga. That's right. All for show.
And he probably had that money. He probably had the money in his pocket.
You know
it's
he
a
did.
It's a gesture.
Yeah.
Yes.
All for show. The Don raised his head inquiringly. Hagen said, he's not on the list, but Luca Brasi wants to see you. He understands it can't be public, but he wants to congratulate you in person. For the first time, the Don seemed displeased. The answer was devious. Is it necessary? I'm going to do this part right. Is it necessary? Hagen shrugged. You understand him better than I do, but he was very grateful that you invited him to the wedding. He never expected that. I think he wants to show his gratitude. Don Corleone nodded and gestured that Luca Brasi should be brought to him. In the garden now, Kay Adams was struck by the violet fury imprinted on the face of Luca Brasi. She asked about him. Michael had brought Kay to the wedding so that she would slowly and perhaps without too much of a shock absorb the truth about his father. But so far, she seemed to regard the Don as a slightly unethical businessman. Michael decided to tell her part of the truth indirectly. He explained that Luca Brasi was one of the most feared men in the Eastern underworld. His great talent, it was said, was that he could do a job of murder all by himself without Confederates, which automatically made discovery and conviction by the law almost impossible. Michael Grimace and said, I don't know whether all that stuff is true. I don't know. He is sort of a friend to my father. For the first time, Kay began to understand. She asked a little incredulously, you're not hinting that a man like that works for your father? The hell with it, he thought. He said straight out, nearly 15 years ago, some people wanted to take over my father's oil importing business. They tried to kill him and nearly did. Luca Brasi went in after them. The story is that he killed 6 men in 2 weeks, and that ended the famous olive oil war. He smiled as if it were a joke. Kay shuddered. You mean your father was shot by gangsters? 15 years ago. Everything's been peaceful since then, he said, afraid he had gone too far. You trying to scare me. You just don't want me to marry you. She smiled at him and poked his ribs with her elbow. Very clever. Michael smiled back at her. I want you to think about it, he said. Did he really kill 6 men? Kay asked. That's what the newspaper claimed. Nobody ever proved it. But there's another story about him that nobody ever tells. It's supposed to be so terrible that even my father won't talk about it. Tom Hagen knows the story, and he won't tell me. Once I kidded him. I said, when will I be old enough to hear the story about Luca? And Tom said, when you're 100. Michael sipped his glass of wine. That must be some story. That must be some Luca. Luca Brasi was indeed a man to frighten the devil in hell himself. Short, squat, massive skull, his presence sent out alarm bells of danger. His face was stamped into a mask of fury. The eyes were brown, but with none of the warmth of that color, more a deadly tan. The mouth was not so much cruel as lifeless, thin, rubbery, and the color of veal. Brasi's reputation for violence was awesome, and his devotion to Don Corleone legendary. He was, in himself, one of the great blocks that supported the Don's power structure. His kind was a rarity. Luca Brasi did not fear the police. He did not fear society. He did not fear God. He did not fear hell. He did not fear or love his fellow man. But he had elected, he had chosen to fear and love Don Corleone. He had elected and he had chosen to fear and love Don Corleone. That's some bad shit. Ushered into the presence of the Don, the terrible Brasi held himself stiff with respect. He stuttered over the flowery congratulations he offered and his formal hope that his first grandchild would be masculine. He then handed the Don an envelope stuffed with cash as a gift for the bridal couple. So that was what he wanted to do. Hagen noticed the change in Don Corleone. Don Corleone thought he was going to kill him, huh? Thought he was just going to run up and shank that motherfucker like goddamn Eddie Murphy brother did on goddamn Dave Chappelle, how he shanked that white man. He was going to run up and shank that motherfucker.
When he was in the apartment.
That's my favorite scene now. I play that shit over and over again.
That's
the white guy's like, what did I do? And then he came over and shanked that motherfucker.
I had sex with Katie Mike.
All right. The Don received Brasi as a king greets a subject who has been Don him, who has, well, the Don received Brasi as a king greets a subject who has done him an enormous service, never familiar but with regal respect. With every gesture, with every word, Don Corleone made it clear to Luca Brasi that he was valued. Not for one moment did he show surprise at the wedding gift being presented to him personally. He understood. The money in the envelope was sure to be more than anyone else had given. Wow. Brazi has spent many hours deciding on the psalm, comparing it to what the other guests might offer. He wanted to be the most generous, to show that he had the most respect. And that was why he had given his envelope to the Don personally, a Gacchieri. Did I say that right? A Gacchieri. The Don overlooked in his own flowery sentence of thanks. Hagen saw Lucas Brazi's face loose its mask of fury, swell with pride and pleasure. Brazi kissed the Don's hand before he went out the door that Hagen held open. Hagen prudently gave Brazi a friendly smile, which the squat man acknowledged with a polite stretching of rubbery, veal-colored lips. When the door closed, Don Corleone gave a small sigh of relief. Nigga didn't kill me. Brazi was the only man in the world who could make him nervous. The man was like a natural force, not truly subject to control, okay? He had to be handled as gingerly as dynamite.
Now that's a live wire. True definition of a live wire.
Yeah, you got to be very careful with a nigga like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Don shrugged. Even dynamite could be exploded harmlessly if the need arose. He looked questioningly at Hagen. Is Bonazzero the only one left? Hagen nodded. Don Corleone frowned in the thought, then said, before you bring him in, tell Santino to come here. He should learn some things. A teaching moment, that's right. Out in the garden, Hagen searched anxiously for Sonny Corleone. He told the waiting Bonazzero to be patient and went over to Michael Corleone and his girlfriend. Did you see Sonny around? He asked. Michael shook his head. Damn, Hagen thought. If Sonny was screwing that goddamn maid of honor all this time, there was going to be a hell of a mess of trouble. His wife, the young girl's family, it could be a disaster. Anxiously, he hurried through the entrance through which he had seen Sonny disappear almost a half an hour ago. Seeing Hagen go into the house, Kay Adams asked Michael Corleone, who is he? You introduced him as your brother, but his name is different, and he certainly doesn't look Italian. Tom lived with us since he was 12 years old. His parents died, and he was roaming around the streets with us with this bad eye infection. Sonny brought him home one night, and he just stayed. He didn't have any place to go. He lived with us until he got married. Kay Adams was thrilled. That's really romantic. Your father must be warm-hearted to adopt somebody just like that when he had so many children of his own. Michael didn't bother to point out that immigrant Italians consider four children a small family. He merely said, Tom wasn't adopted. He just lived with us. Oh, Kay said, then asked curiously, why didn't you adopt him? Michael laughed. Because my father said it would be disrespectful for Tom to change his name, disrespectful to his own parents. All right, now. They saw Hagen shoo Sonny through the French door into the Don's office and then crook a finger at Amerigo Bonazzera. Why do they bother your father with business on a day like this? Kay asked. Michael laughed again. Because they know that by tradition, no Sicilian can refuse a request on his daughter's wedding day. And no Sicilian ever lets a chance like that go by. Lucy Mancini lifted
minute,
up
Don,
her pink.
Wait, Don.
Okay.
Hey, because I thought it must be further into the book where they give the background on Luca Brasi.
Yeah, that's further into the book.
Okay, because right now you just know that he is, as Michael put it,
was it Michael who said he's one of the most dangerous men?
Yeah, yeah, even the devil's okay. scared of the little nigga.
Right, so you will see why he is so held off by the Don. And the reason that they said the Don greeted him like a king greets his valued
subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you'll see that. But to have someone like Luca Brasi has to give you power untold.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Because he's loyal to you beyond loyalty.
That's right.
That's some deep shit to say somebody does not fear God, nor the devil, nor hell, nor...
yeah, but chose to love and respect...
you.
Yeah.
That's
hard. That's gangster. I mean, that nigga did that by choice. Cause he, like, nigga, I ain't really got to. Cause I even hate God. I fuck with God, kill him. Shank his ass. Lucy Mancini lifted up her pink gown off the floor and ran up the steps. Sonny Corleone's heavy cupid face, redly obscene with whiny lust, frightened her. But she had teased him for the past week to just this end. In her two college love affair, she had felt nothing, and neither of them lasted more than a week. Quarreling, her second love had mumbled something about her being too big down there. Lucy had understood, and for the rest of the school term had refused to go out on any dates. During the summer, preparing for the wedding of her best friend, Connie Corleone, Lucy heard the whispered stories about Sonny. One Sunday afternoon in the Corleone's kitchen, Sonny's wife, Sandra, gossiped freely. Sandra was a coarse, good-natured woman who had been born in Italy but brought to America as a small child. She was strongly built with great breasts and had already borne 3 children in 5 years of marriage. Sandra and the other women teased Connie about the terrors of the nuptial bed. My God! Sandra had giggled. When I saw the pole of Sonny's for the first time and realized he was going to stick it in me, I yelled bloody murder. After the first year, my insides felt as mushy as macaroni boiled for an hour. When I heard he was doing the job on other girls, I went to church and lit a candle. They had all laughed, but Lucy had felt her flesh twitching between her legs. Now, as she ran up the steps toward Sonny, a tremendous flash of desire went through her body. On the landing, Sonny grabbed her hand and pulled her down the hall into an empty bedroom. Her legs went weak as the door closed behind them. She felt Sonny's mouth on hers, her lips tasting of burnt tobacco bitter. She opened her mouth. At that moment, she felt his hand come up beneath her bridesmaid's gown, heard the rustle of material given away, felt his large, warm hand between her legs, ripping aside the satin panties to caress her vulva. She put her arms around his neck and hung there as he opened his trousers. Then he placed both hands beneath her bare buttocks and lifted her. She gave a little hop in the air so that both her legs were wrapped around his upper thighs. His tongue was in her mouth, and she sucked on it. He gave her a savage thrust that banged her head against the fucking door. She felt something burning pass between her thighs. She let her right hand drop from his neck and reached down to guide him. Her hand closed around an enormous, blood-gorged dick of muscle. It pulsated in her hand like an animal, and almost weeping with grateful ecstasy, she pointed it into her own wet pussy. The thrust of his entering, The unbelievable pleasure made her gasp, brought her legs up almost around his goddamn neck, and then, like a quiver, her body received the savage arrows of his lightning-like thrusts, innumerable, torching, arching her pelvic higher and higher until, for the first time in her life, she reached in shattering climax, felt his hard dick break, and then the crawly flood of semen over her thighs.
Shit.
Slowly, her legs relaxed from around his body, slid down until they reached the floor. They leaned against each other, out of breath.
You okay, Don?
Can I read that again? I'm going to say, we do that part again. I want to do it better this time. I don't think I read it that good.
And I got some sound effects.
It might have been going on for some time, but now they could hear the soft knocking on the door. Sonny quickly buttoned his trousers, meanwhile blocking the door so that it could not be opened. Lucy frantically smoothed down her pink gown, her eyes flickering, but the thing that had given her so much pleasure was hidden inside sober black cloth. Then they heard Tom Hagen's voice, very low. Sonny, you in there? Sonny sighed with relief. He winked at Lucy. Yeah, Tom, what is it? Hagen's voice, still low, said, the Don wants you in his office now. They could hear his footsteps as he walked away. Sonny waited a few moments, gave Lucy a hard kiss on the goddamn lips, and then slipped out the door after Hagen. Lucy combed her hair. She checked the dress and pulled around her garter straps. Her body felt bruised, her lips pulpy and tender. She didn't even wash her pussy. She went out the door, and though she felt the sticky wetness between her thighs, she did not go to the bathroom to wash her ass, but ran straight on down them goddamn steps and into the garden.
Nasty.
She took her seat at the bridal table next to Connie, who exclaimed petulantly, Lucy, where were you? You look drunk. Stay beside me now. The blonde groom poured Lucy a glass of wine and smiled knowingly. Lucy didn't care. Lucy didn't give a fuck. She lifted the grapey dark red juice to her parched mouth and drank. She felt the sticky wetness of Sunny, nasty, calm, big dick between her thighs and pressed her legs together. Her body was trembling. Over the glass of rim, as she drank, her eyes searched hungrily to find Sonny Corleone. There was no one else she cared to see. Slyly, she whispered in Connie's ear, only a few hours more, and you'll know what it's all about. Connie giggled. Lucy demurely folded her hands on the table, treacherously triumphant, as she had stolen a treasure from the bride. Amerigo Bonacera followed Hagen into the corner room of the house, and this is my favorite part right here, even though it's the first part of the movie. I fucking love this shit. Amerigo Bonacera followed Hagen into the corner room of the house and found Don Corleone sitting behind a huge desk. Sonny Corleone was standing by the window looking out into the garden. For the first time that afternoon, the Don behaved coolly. He did not embarrass the visitor or shake hands.
He did not embrace the visitor or shake hands.
The sallow-faced undertaker owed his invitation to the fact that his wife and the wife of the Don were the closest of friends. Amerigo Bonacera himself was in severe disfavor with Don Corleone. Excuse me, slip of a tongue. Slip of a tongue there. Bonacera began his request obliquely and cleverly. You must excuse my daughter, your wife's goddaughter, for not doing your family the respect of coming today. she is in the hospital still. You must excuse my daughter, your wife's goddaughter, for not doing your family the respect of coming today. She is in the hospital still. He glanced at Sonny Corleone and Tom Hagen to indicate that he did not wish to speak before them, but the Don was merciless. We all have acknowledged. Nope, we all know of your daughter's misfortune. The fuck I get acknowledged from? That shit ain't nowhere in this bitch. We all... fuck was that? That shit just popped up on the screen. We all know your daughter's misfortune. If I can help her in any way, you'll have only to speak. My wife is here. No. My wife is her godmother, after all. I have never forgotten that honor. This was a rebuke. The Undertaker never called Don Corleone godfather, as custom dictated. Bonazera, ashen face, acts directly now. May I speak to you alone? Don Corleone shook his head. I trust these two men with my life, motherfucker. They are my two right arms. I cannot insult them by sending them away. They are my two right arms. The Undertaker closed his eyes for a moment and then began to speak. His voice was quiet, the voice he used to console the bereaved. Yo, that was classic line. Same voice he used when he working. Damn. I raised my daughter in American fashion. I believe in America. America has made my fortune. I gave my daughter her freedom, and yet taught her never to dishonor her family. She found a boyfriend, not an Italian. She went to the movies with him. She stayed out late, but he never came to meet her parents. I accepted all this without a protest. The fault is mine. 2 months ago, he took her for a drive. He had a masculine friend with him. They made her drink whiskey, and then they tried to take advantage of her. She resisted. She kept her honor. They beat her like an animal. When I went to the hospital, she had 2 black eyes. Her nose was broken. Her jaw was shattered. They had to wire it together. She wept through her pain. Father, why did they do it? Why did they do this to me? And I wept. Bonazera could not speak further. He was weeping now, though his voice had not betrayed his emotions. Don Corleone, as if against his will, made a gesture of sympathy, and Bonazera went on, his voice human with suffering. Why did I weep? She was the light of my life, an affectionate daughter. A beautiful girl. She trusted people, and now she will never trust them again. She will never be beautiful again. He was trembling, his sallow face flushed an ugly dark red. I went to the police like a good American. The 2 boys were arrested. They were brought to trial. The evidence was overwhelming, and they pleaded guilty. The judge sentenced them 3 years in prison and suspended the sentence. They went free that very day. I stood in the courtroom like a fool, and those bastards smiled at me. And then I said to my wife, we must go to Don Corleone's for justice. The Don had bowed his head to show respect for the man's grief. But when he spoke, the words were cold with offended dignity. Why did you go to the police? Why didn't you come to me at the beginning of this affair? Bonazera muttered almost inaudibly. What do you want me to do? Tell me what you wish, but do what I beg you to do. There was something almost insolent in his words. Don Corleone said gravely, "And what is that?" Bonazera glanced at Hagen and Sonny Corleone and shook his head. The Don, still sitting at Hagen's desk, inclined his body toward the undertaker. Bonazera hesitated, then bent down and put his lips so close to the Don's hairy ear that they touched. Don Corleone listened like a priest in a confessional, gazing away into the distance, impassive, remote. They stood so for a long moment until Bonazera finished whispering and straightened to his full height. The Don looked up gravely at Bonazera. Bonazera, his face flushed, returned the stare unflinchingly. Finally, the Don spoke. "That I cannot do. You are being carried away." Bonazera said loudly, clearly, "I will pay you anything you ask." On hearing this, Hagen flinched, a nervous flick of his head. Sonny Corleone folded his arms, smiled sardonically as he turned from the window to watch the scene in the room for the first time. Don Corleone rose from behind the desk when he picked that fucking cat and put that motherfucker down. They were patting that cat like a fucking pimp. Don Corleone rose from behind the desk. His face was still impassive, but his voice rang like cold death. "We have known each other many years, you and I. But until this day, you never came to me for counsel or help. I can't remember the last time you invited me to your house for coffee, though my wife is your godmother, is godmother to your only child. Let us be frank, motherfucker. You spurned my friendship. You feared to be in my debt." Bonazera murmured, "I didn't want to get into trouble." The Don held up his hand. "No, don't speak. You found America as paradise. You had a good trade. You made a good living. You thought the world a harmless place where you could take your pleasure as you willed. You never armed yourself with true friends. After all, the police guarded you. There were courts of law. You and yours could come to no harm. You did not need Don Corleone. Very well. My feelings were wounded. But I am not the sort of person why thrust his friendship on those who do not value it, on those who think me of little account." The Don paused and gave the undertaker a polite, ironic smile. "Now you come to me and say, Don Corleone, give me justice. And you do not ask with respect. You do not offer me your friendship. You come into my home on the bridal day of my daughter, and you ask me to do murder, and you say," here's the Don's voice became a scornful, mimicky cry, "I will pay you anything. No, no, I am not offended. But what have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectful?" Bonazera cried out in an anguish and fear, anguish and his fear. "America has been good to me. I wanted to be a good citizen. I wanted my child to be an American." The Don clapped his hands together with decisive approval. "Well spoken. Very fine. Then you have nothing to complain about. The judge has ruled. America has ruled, motherfucker. Bring your daughter flowers and a box of candy next time you go visit her ass in the hospital. That should comfort her. Be content. After all, this is not a serious affair. The boys were young, high-spirited, and one of them is the son of a powerful politician." "No, my dear Amerigo, you have always been honest, I must admit. Though you spurned my friendship, that I would trust the given word of Amerigo Bonazera more than I would any other man's. So give me your word that you will put aside this madness. It is not American. Forgive, forget, Life is full of misfortunes. The cruel and contemptuous irony with which all this was said, the controlled anger of the Don reduced the poor undertaker to a quivering jelly, but he spoke up bravely again. I ask for justice, Don Corleone said courtly. The court gave you justice, motherfucker. Bonazzera shook his head stubbornly. No, they gave the youth justice. They did not give me justice. The Don acknowledged this fine distinction with an approval nod, then asked, what is your justice? An eye for an eye, Bonazzera said. You ask for more, the Don said. Your daughter is still alive. Bonazzera said reluctantly, let them suffer as she suffers. The Don waited for him to speak further. Bonazzera screwed up the last of his courage and said, how much shall I pay you? It was a despairing wail. Don Corleone turned his back. It was a dismissal. Bonazzera did not budge. Finally, sighing, a good-hearted man who cannot remain angry with an erring friend, Don Corleone turned back to the undertaker, who was now as pale as one of his corpses. Don Corleone was gentle, patient. Why do you fear to give your first alliance to me, allegiance to me? You go to the law courts and wait for months. You spend money on lawyers who know full well you are to be made a fool of. You accept judgment from a judge who sells himself like the worst whore in the streets. Years gone by when you needed money. You went to the banks and paid ruinous interest. Waited hat in hand like a beggar while they sniffed around, poked their noses up your very asshole to make sure you could pay them back.
That's right.
The Don paused. His voice became sterner. But if you had come to me, my purse would have been yours. If you had come to me for justice, those scum who ruined your daughter would be weeping bitter tears this day. If by some misfortune an honest man like yourself made enemies, they would become my enemies. The Don raised his arm, finger pointing at Bonazzera, and then, believe me, they would fear you. Bonazzera bowed his head and murmured in a strangled voice, be my friend. I accept. Don Corleone put his hand on the man's shoulder. Good. You shall have your justice. Someday, and that day may never come, I will call upon you to do me a service in return. Until that day, consider this justice a gift from my wife, your daughter's godmother. Yeah, from his wife. As great as your faith, white bitch, your daughter should be healed. Not my faith. When the door closed behind the grateful undertaker, Don Corleone turned to Hagen and said, give this affair to Clemenza and tell him to be sure to use reliable people, people who will not be carried away by the smell of blood. After all, we're not murderers, no matter what that corpse valet dreams up in his foolish head. He noted that his firstborn, masculine son was gazing through the window at the garden party. It was hopeless, Don Corleone thought. If he refused to be instructed, Santino could never run the family business, could never become a Don. He would have to find somebody else, and soon. After all, he was not immortal. From the garden, startling all three men, there came a happy roaring shout. Sonny Corleone pressed close to the window. What he saw made him move quickly toward the door, a delighted smile on his face. It's Johnny. He came to the wedding. What did I tell you? Hagen moved to the window. It's really your godson, he said to Don Corleone. Shall I bring him here? No, the Don said. Let the people enjoy him. Let him come to me when he's ready. He smiled at Hagen. You see? He's a good son. He's a good godson. He liked that nigga. Hagen felt a twinge of jealousy. You see, he's a good godson. Hagen felt a twinge of jealousy. He was dryly. It's been 2 years. He's probably in trouble again and wants you to help. And who should he come to if not his godfather? Asked Don Corleone. Dun, 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 dun. That's right. Hold on, shout out and keep pushing this shit.
That was a powerful scene, that whole scene of all the people who came in to talk to him, and then Bonasaro having to come in and face the one thing he didn't want to ever have to do was to
bow down to get back
bow
up.
Bow down to Don Corleone. Yes.
He truly believed in assimilation with America. That was his problem. He forgot where he came from.
That's right. As we see happening with a lot of people, they forget who they are. They want to forget who they are. And so they get caught up in the whirlwind, and they keep sitting around talking about we want justice.
No justice, no peace.
He even said, you went to their banks. My purse would have been yours. No interest.
Your enemies would have been mine.
Mm.
And they would have feared you. Huh. Yeah.
You didn't want to be my friend.
Mm. They want to associate.
Would you be my friend? Godfather, kiss my fucking ring first. Will you be my friend? The first one to see Johnny Fontaine enter the garden was Connie Corleone. She forgot her bridal dignity and screamed, Johnny! 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 Then she ran into his arms. He hugged her tight and kissed her on the mouth, kept his arms around her as others came up to greet him. They were all his old friends, people he had grown up with on the West Side. Then Connie was dragging him to her new husband. Johnny saw with amusement that the blonde young man looked a little sour at no longer being the star of the day. He turned on all his charm, shaking the groom's hand, toasting him with a glass of wine. A familiar voice called from the bandstand. How about giving us a song, Johnny? He looked up and saw Nino Valenti smiling down at him. Johnny Fontaine jumped up on the bandstand and threw his arms around Nino. They had been inseparable, singing together, going out with girls together, until Johnny had started to become famous and sing on the radio. When he had gone to Hollywood to make movies, Johnny had phoned Nino a couple of times just to talk and had promised to get him a club singing date. But he had never done so. Seeing Nino now, his cheerful, mocking, drunken grin, all the affection returned. Nino began strumming on the mandolin. Johnny Fontaine put his hand on Nino's shoulder. This is for the bride, he said, and stamping his foot, chanting the words to an obscene Sicilian love song. As he sang, Nino made suggestive motions with his body. The bride blushed proudly. The throng of guests roared disapproval. Before the song ended, they were all stamping with their feet and roaring out the sly. Double-meaning tagline that finished each stanza. At the end, they would not stop applauding until Johnny cleared his throat to sing another song. They were all proud of him. He was of them, and he had become a famous singer, a movie star who slept with the most desired women in the world, And yet he had shown proper respect for his godfather by traveling 3,000 miles to attend this wedding. He still loved old friends like Nino Valenti. Many of the people there had seen Johnny and Nino singing together when they were just boys, when no one dreamed that Johnny Fontaine would grow up to hold the hearts of 50 million women in his hands. Johnny Fontaine reached down and lifted the bride up onto the bandstand so that Connie stood between him and Nino. Both men crouched down facing each other, Nino plucking the mandolin for a few harsh chords. It was an old routine of theirs, a mock battle and wooing, using their voices like swords, each shouting a chorus in turn. With the most delicate courtesy, Johnny let Nino's voice overwhelm his own. Let Nino take the bride from his arm. Let Nino swing into the last victorious stanza while his own voice died away. The whole wedding party broke into shouts of applause. The three of them embraced each other at the end. The guests begged for another song. Only Don Corleone, standing in the corner entrance of the house, sensed something amiss. Cheeringly, with bluff good humor, careful not to give offense to his guests, he called out, "My godson has come 3,000 miles to do us honor, and no one thinks to wet his throat." At once, a dozen full wine glasses were thrust at Johnny Fontaine. He took a sip from all and rushed to embrace his godfather. As he did so, he whispered something into the older man's ear. Don Corleone led him into the house. Tom Hagen held out his hand when Johnny came into the room. Johnny shook it and said, "How are you, Tom?" But without his usual charm that consisted of a genuine warmth for people, Hagen was a little hurt by this coolness, but shrugged it off. It was one of the penalties for being the Don's hatchet man. Johnny Fontaine said to the Don, "When I got the wedding invitation, I said to myself, my godfather isn't mad at me anymore. I called you 5 fucking times after my divorce, my nigga, and Tom always told me you were out of business, so I knew you were sore." Don Corleone was filling glasses from the yellow bottle of Strega. "That's all forgotten now. Can I do something for you still? You're not too famous, too rich that I can't help you." Johnny gulped down the yellow fiery liquid and held out his glass to be refilled. He tried to sound jaunty. "I'm not rich, Godfather. I'm going down. You were right. I should never have left my wife and kids for that tramp bitch I married. I don't blame you for getting sore at me." The Don shrugged. "I worried about you. You're my godson, that's all." Johnny paced up and down the room. "I was crazy about that bitch. The biggest star in Hollywood. She looked like an angel. And you know what she does after a picture? If the makeup man does a good job on her face, she lets him bang her. If the cameraman made her look extra good, she brings him into her dressing room and gives him a screw. Anybody. She uses her body like I used the loose change in my goddamn pocket for a tip. A slut, a whore, a nasty bitch. Made for the devil." Don Corleone courtly broke in. "How's your family?" Johnny sighed. "I took care of them. After the divorce, I gave Jenny and the kids more than the court said I should. I go see them once a week. I miss them. Sometimes I think I'm going crazy." He took another drink. "Now, my second wife laughs at me. She can't understand my being jealous. She calls me an old-fashioned guinea. She makes fun of my singing. Before I left, I gave her a nice beating, but not in the face because she was making a picture. I gave that bitch cramps. I punched her in her arms and legs like a kid, and she kept laughing at me." He lit a cigarette. "So, Godfather." Wait, let's light a cigarette. "So, Godfather, right now, life doesn't seem worth living. Don Corleone said simply, these are troubles I can't help you with. These are troubles I can't help you with. He paused, then asked, what's the matter with your voice? All the assured charm, the self-mockery disappeared from Johnny Fontaine's face. He said almost brokenly, Godfather, I can't sing anymore. Something happened to my throat. The doctors don't know what. Hagen and Adon looked at him with surprise. Johnny had always been so tough. Fontaine went on. My two pitchers, he's smoking, remember? My two pitchers made a lot of money. I was a big star. Now they throw me out. The head of the studio always hated my guts, and now he's paying me off. Don Corleone stood before his godson and asked grimly, why doesn't this man like you? I used to sing those songs for the liberal organizations, you know, all that stuff you never liked me to do. Jack Waltz didn't like it either. He called me a communist, but he couldn't make it stick. Then I snatched the girl he had saved for himself. It was strictly one night stand, and she came after me. What the hell could I do? Then my whore, second wife bitch, throws me out. And Jenny and the kids won't take me back unless I come crawling on my goddamn hands and knees. I can't sing no more. Godfather, what the hell can I do? Don Corleone's face had become cold without a hint of sympathy. He said contemptuously, you can start acting like a man, motherfucker. Suddenly, anger contorted his face. He shouted, like a man! Act like a motherfucking man! He reached over the desk and grabbed Johnny Fontaine by the hair of his head in a gesture that was savagely affectionate. By Christ in heaven, is it possible that you spend so much time in my presence and turn out no better than this? A Hollywood Finocchio who weeps and begs for pity, who cries out like a woman, what shall I do? Oh, what shall I do? The mimicry of the Don was so extraordinary, so unexpected, that Hagen and Johnny were startled into laughter. Don Corleone was pleased. For a moment, he reflected on how much he loved his godson. How would his own three sons have reacted to such a tongue lashing? Santino would have sulked and behaved badly for weeks afterward. Fredo would have been cowed. Michael would have given him a cold smile and gone out the house not to be seen for months. But Johnny, what a fine chap he was, smiling now, gathering strength, knowing already the true purpose of his godfather, okay? Don Corleone went on. You took the woman of your boss, dumbass, a man more powerful than yourself, dumbass. Then you complain he won't help you. What nonsense. You left your family, dumbass, your children without a father, dumbass, to marry a fucking whore, and you weep because they don't welcome you back with open arms. The whore, you don't hit her in the goddamn face because she's making a motherfucking picture. Then you are amazed because she laughs at you. You live like a goddamn fool, and you come to a fool's end. And you have come to a fool's end. Don Corleone paused to ask in a patient voice, are you willing to take my goddamn advice this time, motherfucker? What up, Naratu? Are you willing to take my advice this time? Hold on. Johnny Fontaine shrugged. I can't marry Jenny again. Not the way she wants. I have to gamble. I have to drink. I have to go out with the boys. Beautiful broads run after me, and I never could resist them. Then I used to feel like a heel when I went back to Jenny. Christ, I can't go through all that shit again. It was a rare that Don Corleone showed exasperation. I didn't tell you to get married again. Do what you want. It's good you wish to be a father to your children. A man who is not a father to his children can never be a real man. But then you must make their mother accept you. Who says you can't see them every day? Who says you can't live in the same house? Who says you can't live your life exactly as you want to live it? Johnny Fontaine laughed. Godfather, not all women are like the old Italian wives. Jenny won't stand for it. Now the Don was mocking. Because you acted like, Finocchio. Because you acted like Finocchio. You gave her more than the court said. You didn't hit the other in the face because she was making a picture. You let women dictate your goddamn actions. And they are not competent in this world. And they are not competent in this world. Though certainly they will be saints in heaven while we men burn in hell. And then I've watched you all these years. You've been a fine godson. You've given me all the respect. But what of your other old friends? One year you run around with this person, the next year with another person. That Italian boy who was so funny in the movies, he had some bad luck and you never saw him again because you were more famous. And how about your old comrade that you went to school with, who was your partner singing? Nino. He drinks too goddamn much out of disappointment, but he never complains. He works hard driving the gravel truck and sings weekends for a few dollars. He never says anything against you. You couldn't help him a bit. Why not? He sings well. Johnny Fontaine said with patient wariness, Godfather, I just hasn't got enough talent. I'm sorry, Godfather, he just hasn't got enough talent. He's okay, but he's not big time. Don Corleone lifted his eyes, almost closed, and then said, and you, godson, you now, you just don't have talent enough. Shall I get you a job on the gravel truck with Nino? When Johnny didn't answer, the Don went on. 90 seconds going to overtime. Friendship is everything. Friendship is more than talent. It is more than government. It is almost the equal of family. Never forget that. If you had built up a wall of friendship, you wouldn't have to ask me to help. Now tell me, why can't you sing? You sang well in the garden, as well as Nino. Hagen and Johnny smiled at this delicate thrust. It was Johnny's turn. It was Johnny's turn to be patronizingly patient. My voice is weak. I sing one or two songs, and then I can't sing again for hours or days. I can't make it through the rehearsals or the retakes. My voice is weak. It got some sort of sickness. So you have women trouble. Your voice is sick. Now tell me the trouble you're having with this Hollywood peasant avante who won't let you work. The Don was getting down to business. He's bigger than one of your pezzano vantes, Johnny said. He owns the studio. He advises the president on movie propaganda for the war. Just a month ago, he bought the movie rights to the biggest novel of the year, a bestseller. And the main character is a guy just like me. I wouldn't even have to act, just be myself. I wouldn't even have to sing. I might even win the Academy Award. Everybody knows it's perfect for me, and I'll be big again as an actor. But that bastard Jack Waltz is paying me off. He won't give it to me. I offered to do it for nothing, for a minimum price, and he still says no. He sent the word that if I come and kiss his ass in the studio commissary, maybe he'll think about it. Don Corleone dismissed this emotional nonsense with a wave of his hand. Among reasonable men, problems of business could always be solved. He patted his godson on the shoulder. You're discouraged. Nobody cares about you, so you think. You've lost a lot of weight. You drink a lot, eh? You don't sleep and you take pills. He shook his head disapprovingly. Now I want you to follow my orders. I want you to stay in my house for 1 month. I want you to eat well, to rest and sleep. I want you to be my companion. I enjoy your company, and maybe you can learn something about the world from your godfather that might even help you in the great Hollywood. But no singing, no drinking, and no women. And at the end of the month, you can go back to Hollywood, and this Pezum Vante, this 90 caliber, will give you that job you want. Done? Johnny Fontaine could not altogether believe that the Don had such power, but his godfather had never said such a thing could be done without having it done. This guy is a personal friend of J. Edgar Hoover, Johnny said. Oh, wait. This guy is a personal friend of J. Edgar Hoover. You can't even raise your voice to him. He's a businessman, the Don said blandly. I'll make him an offer he can't refuse. It's too late, Johnny said. All the contracts have been signed and they started shooting in a week. It's absolutely impossible. Don Corleone said, take your ass back to the goddamn party. Your friends are waiting for you. Leave everything up to me, dumbass. He pushed Johnny Fontaine out of the room. Hagen sat behind the desk and made notes. The Don heaved his sigh and asked, is there anything else? Salazzo can't be put off anymore. You'll have to see him this week. Hagen held his pen over the calendar. The Don shrugged. Now that the wedding is over, whenever you like. This answer told Hagen two things. Most important, that the answer to Virgil Salazzo would be no end. The second, that Don Corleone, since he would not give the answer before his daughter's wedding, expected his no to cause trouble. Hagen said cautiously, shall I tell Clemenza to have some men come live in the house? But Don said impatiently, for what? I didn't answer before the wedding because on an important day like that, there should be no cloud, not even in the distance. Also, I wanted to know beforehand what he wanted to talk about. We know now what he would propose is an infamita. Hagen asked, then you will refuse? When the Don nodded, Hagen said, I think we should all discuss it, the whole family, before you give your answer. The Don smiled. You think so? Good. We will discuss it. When you come back from California, I want you to fly there tomorrow and settle this business for Johnny. See that movie, Pezzavante. Tell Salazzo I'll see him when you get back from California. Is there anything else? Hagen said formally, the hospital call. Consigliere abandoned is dying. He won't last out the night. His family was told to come and wait. Hagen had filled the consigliere post for the past year, ever since the cancer had imprisoned Ginkgo Abandonando in his hospital bed. Now he waited to hear Don Corleone say the post was his permanently. The odds were against it. So high a position was traditionally given only to a man descended from two Italian parents. There had already been trouble about his temporary performance of the duties. Also, he was only 35, not old enough, supposedly, to have acquired the necessary experience and cunning for a successful consigliere. But the Don gave him no encouragement. He asked, when does my daughter leave with her bridegroom? Hagen looked at his wristwatch. In a few minutes, they'll cut the cake, and then a half an hour after that. That reminded him of something else. Your new son-in-law, do we give him something important inside the family? He was surprised at the vehemence of the Don's answer. Never. 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 Never give him something. Never. Give him something to earn his living, a good living, but never let him know the family's business. tell the others, Sonny Fredo Clemenza, the Don Pauls. Instruct my sons, all three of them, that they will accompany me to the hospital to see poor Ginkgo. And I want them to pay their last respects. Tell Fredo to drive the big car and ask Johnny if he will come with us as a special favor to me. He saw Hagen look at him questioningly. I want you to go to California tonight. You won't have time to go see Ginkgo, but don't leave until I come back from the hospital and speak with you. Understood? Understood. Hagen said, what time should Fred have the car waiting? When the guests have left, Ginkgo will wait for me. He was smooth as fuck, right? He said, Ginkgo ain't finna die. He'll wait for me. He'll hold on just to see my ass. The senator called The senator called, Hagen said, apologized for not coming personally, but that you would understand. He probably means those two FBI men across the street taking down the license number, but he sent his gift over by special messenger. The Don nodded. He did not think it necessary to mention that he himself had warned the senator not to come. Did he send a nice present? Hagen made a face of impressed approval that was very strangely Italian on his German-Irish features. Antique silver, very valuable. The kids can sell it for a grand at least. The senator spent a lot of time getting exactly the right thing. For those kind of people, that's more important than how much it costs. Don Corleone did not hide his pleasure that so great a man as the senator had shown him such respect. The senator, like Luca Brasi, was one of the great stones in the Don's power structure, and he too, with this gift, had re-sown his loyalty. When Johnny Fontaine appeared in the garden, Kay Adams recognized him immediately. She was truly surprised. You never told me your family knew Johnny Fontaine, nigga. Now I'm sure I'm gonna marry your ass. Do you want to meet him, bitch? Nah, not now. I was in love with him for 3 years. I used to come down to New York whenever he sang at the Capitol and scream my head off. He was so wonderful. We'll meet him later, Michael said. When Johnny finished singing and vanished into the house with Don Corleone, Kay said archly to Michael, don't tell me a big movie star like Johnny Fontaine has to ask your father for a favor. He's my father's grandson, Kay. And if it wasn't for my father, he might not be a big movie star today. Kay Adam laughed with delight. That sounds like another great story. Michael shook his head. I can't tell that one, he said. Trust me, she said. Tell me. Oh, sure, the word is trust me. Trust me, she said. He told her. He told her without being funny. He told it without pride. He told it without any sort of explanation except that 8 years before his father had been more impetuous, and because the matter concerned his godson, the Don considered it an affair of personal honor. The story was quickly told. 8 years ago, Johnny Fontaine had made an extraordinary success singing with a popular dance band. He had become a top radio attraction. Unfortunately, the band leader, a well-known show business personality named Les Haley, had signed Johnny to a 5-year personal services contract. It was a common show business practice. Les Haley could now loan Johnny out and pocket most of the money. Don Corleone entered the negotiations personally. He offered Les Haley $20,000 to release Johnny Fontaine from the personal services contract. Haley offered to take only 50% of Johnny's earnings. Don Corleone was amused. He dropped his offer from $20,000 to $10,000. The band leader, obviously not a man of the world outside of his beloved show business, completely missed the significance of this lower offer. He refused. The next day, Don Corleone went to see the band leader personally. He brought with him his two best friends, Ginko Abadando, Ginko Abadando, who was his concierge, and Luca Brasi. With no other witnesses, Don Corleone persuaded Les Haley to sign a document giving up all rights to all services from Johnny Fontaine upon payment of a certified check to the amount of $10,000. Don Corleone did this by putting a pistol to the forehead of the band leader and assuring him with the utmost seriousness that either his signature or his brains would rest on that document in exactly 1 minute. Les Haley signed that goddamn document. Don Corleone pocketed his pistol and handed over the certified check. The rest was history. Johnny Fontaine went on to become the greatest singing sensation in the country. He made Hollywood musicals that earned a fortune for his studio. His records made millions of dollars. Then he divorced his childhood sweetheart wife and left his two children to marry the most glamorous blonde star in motion pictures. He soon learned that she was a goddamn whore. He drank, he gambled, he chased other women, he lost his singing voice, his records stopped selling, the studio did not renew his contract, and so now he had come back to his godfather. Kay said thoughtfully, "Are you sure you're not jealous of your father? Everything you've told me about him shows him doing something for other people. You must be good. He must be good-hearted." She smiled. Never were Riley. Riley? What the fuck is that? Riley? You sure? How you spell it, Doc?
W-R-Y-L.
Okay, I forgot you're a smart nigga. Of course, his methods are not exactly constitutional. Michael sighed. I guess that's the way it sounds, but let me tell you this. You know those Arctic explorers who leave caches of food scattered on the route to the North Pole, just in case they may need them someday? That's my father's favors. Someday, he'll be at each one of those people houses, and they had better come across.
Dun, 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 dun.
It was nearly twilight before the wedding cake was shown, exclaimed over and eaten. Specially baked by Nazarene, it was clearly decorated with shells of cream, so dizzyingly delicious that the bride greedily plucked them from the corpse of the cake before she whizzed away on her honeymoon with her blonde groom. The Don politely spared his guest's departure, noting meanwhile that the black sedan with its FBI men was no longer visible. Finally, the only car left in the driveway was the long black Cadillac with Freddie at the wheel. The Don got into the front seat, moving with quick coordination for his age and bulk. Sonny, Michael, and Johnny Fontaine got into the back seat. Don Corleone said to his son, Michael, "Your girlfriend, she'll get back to the city by herself, all right?" Michael nodded. Tom said, "He'll take care of it." Don Corleone nodded with satisfaction at Hagen's efficiency. Because of the gas rationing still in effect, there was little traffic on the Belt Parkway to Manhattan. In less than an hour, the Cadillac rolled into the street of French Hospital. During the ride, Don Corleone asked his youngest son if he was doing well in school. Michael nodded. Then Sonny in the back seat asked his father, "Johnny says you're getting him squared away with that Hollywood business. Do you want me to go out there and help?" Don Corleone was curt. "Tom is going tonight. He won't need any help. It's a simple affair." Sonny Corleone laughed. "Johnny thinks you can fix it. That's why I thought you might want me to go out there." Don Corleone turned his head. "Why do you doubt me?" He asked Johnny Fontaine, "Hasn't your godfather always done what he has he would do? Hasn't your godfather always done what he said he would do? Have I ever been taken for a fool?" Johnny apologized nervously. "Godfather, the man who runs it, is a real 90 caliber Pesavanta. You can't budge him, not even with money. He has big connections, and he hates me. I just don't know how you can swing it. The Don spoke with affectionate amusement. I say to you, you shall have it. He nudged Michael with his elbow. We won't disappoint my godson, huh, Michael? Michael, who never doubted his father for a moment, shook his head. As they walked towards the hospital entrance, Don Corleone put his hand on Michael's arm so that the others forged ahead. When you get through with college, come and talk to me. I have some plans you would like. Michael didn't say anything. Don Corleone grunted in exasperation. I know how you are. I won't ask you to do anything you don't approve of. This is something special. Go your own way now. You're a man after all, but come to me as a son should when you have finished with your schooling.
Dun 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 dun
dun dun. The family of Ginkgo Abidando, wife and three daughters, dressed in black, clustered like a flock of plump crows on the white tile floor of the hospital corridor. When they saw Don Corleone come out of the elevator, they seemed to flutter up off the white tiles in an instinctive surge toward him for protection. The mother was regally stout and black, the daughters fat and plain. Miss Abidando pecked at Don Corleone's cheek, sobbing, wailing, "Oh, what a saint you are to come here on your daughter's wedding day." Don Corleone brushed these thanks aside. "Don't I owe respect to such a friend who has been my right hand for 20 years? He had understood immediately that the soon-to-be widow did not comprehend that her husband would die this night. Ginkgo Abidando had been in this hospital for nearly a year dying of his cancer, and the wife had come to consider his fatal illness almost an ordinary part of life. Tonight was just another crisis. She babbled on. "Go on in and see my poor husband. He asked for you. Poor man, he wanted to come to the wedding to show his respect, but the doctor would not permit it. Then he said you would come to see him on this great day, but I did not believe it possible. Men understand friendship more than we women. Go inside. You will make him happy." A nurse and a doctor came out of Ginkgo Abidando's private room. The doctor was a young man, serious face, and with the air of one born to command. That is to say, the air of one who has been immensely rich all his goddamn life. One of the daughters asked timidly, "Dr. Kennedy, can we go to see him now?" Dr. Kennedy looked over the large group with exasperation. Didn't these people realize that the man inside was dying and dying in torturous pain? It would be much better if everyone let him die in peace. "I think just the immediate family," he said in his exquisitely polite voice. He was surprised when the wife and daughters turned to the short, heavy man dressed in an awkward fitted tuxedo as if to hear his decision. The heavy man spoke. There was just the slightest trace of an Italian accent in his voice. "My dear doctor, is it true he's dying?" "Yes," said Dr. Kennedy. "Then there is nothing more for you to do, nigga. We will take up the burden. We will comfort him. We will close his eyes. We will bury him and weep at his funeral. And afterwards, we will watch over his wife and children, his wife and daughters. Because, motherfucker, you can't, so get out the fucking way. Trying to call shots. Like you on the wheel, motherfucker. Ah, y'all niggas be, don't you, Doc? Little fuck niggas. Little fuck doctors be like that. Only there was too many people in the waiting room. Only the immediate family, the wife and the kids. Who the fuck is you, fuck nigga? Fine line. Why the motherfucker beat all that? Y'all niggas need to be slapped with that shit.
Like
Ain't nothing else you can do. This is when we step in, you dumb motherfucker. You dumb Americans. We read the book. We saw the third. Anyway, where were we before we was rudely interrupted by the doctor? Dr. Kennedy shrugged. It was impossible to explain these peasants, see? At the same time, he recognized the crude justice in the man's remarks. His role was over. Still, exquisitely. Nope. Fraulein, what that word?
Yeah, you're right. Exquisitely.
Oh, okay. Still exquisitely polite, he said, please wait for the nurse to let you in. She has a few necessary things to do with the patient. He walked away from them down the corridor, his white lab coat flapping. Don't you hate when they call them patients? You talk to the family, they should say, you know, okay, never mind. The nurse went back into the room, and they waited. Finally, she came out again, holding the door for them to enter. She whispered, he's delirious with the pain and fever. Try not to excite him, and you can stay only for a few minutes, except for the wife. She recognized Johnny Fontaine as he went by her, and her eyes opened wide. He gave her a faint smile of acknowledgement, and she stared at him with frank invitation. He filled her away for future references, then followed the others into the sick man's room.
Dog.
Oh, he filed her away for future. Okay, yeah, he filed
dog.
Away. What, filed out?
Dog. Ain't that a man's dog?
Oh, a dog. Mm-hmm. He filed her away for future references. Then I'm gonna fuck this bitch next week. Come back and get this bitch. Okay, Geico Abadando had run a long race with death and now vanquished. He lay exhausted on the raised bed. He was wasted away to no more than a skeleton, and what had once been vigorous black hair had turned into obscene stringy wisp. Don Corleone said cheeringly, Geico, dear friend, I have brought my sons to pay their respects. And look, even Johnny, all the way from Hollywood. The dying man raised his fevered eyes gratefully to the Don. He let the young men clasp his bony hand in their fleshy ones. His wife and daughters ranged themselves along his bed, kissing his cheek, taking his other hand in turn. The Don pressed his old friend's hand. He said comfortingly, hurry up and get better, and we'll take a trip back to Italy together to our old village. We'll play bocce in front of the wine shop like our fathers before us. The dying man shook his head. He motioned the young men and his family away from his bedside. With the other bony claw, he hung fast to the Don. He tried to speak. The Don put his head down and then sat it on the bedside chair. Geico Abadando was babbling about their childhood. Then his cold black eyes became sly. He whispered. The Don bent closer. The others in the room were astonished to see tears running down Don Corleone's face as he shook his head. The quivering voice grew louder, filling the room. With a tortured, superhuman effort, Abadando lifted his head off his pillow, eyes unseeing, and pointed a skeletal forefinger at the Don. Godfather, Godfather, he said out blindly, save me from death, I beg you. My flesh is burning off my bones, and I can feel the worms eating away my brain. Godfather, cure me. You have the power. Dry the tears of my poor wife. And Corleone, we played together as children. And now you will let me die when I fear hell for my sins. The Don was silent. Abadando said, it is your daughter's wedding day. You cannot refuse me. The Don spoke quietly, gravely, to pierce through the blasphemous delirium. Old friend, I have no such powers. If I did, I would be more merciful than God, believe me. But don't fear death and don't fear hell. I will have a mass said for your soul every night and every morning. Your wife and children I will pray for. How can God punish you with so many pleas for mercy? The skeleton face took on a cunning expression that was obscene. Abadanda said slyly, "It's been arranged then?" Yo. When the Don answered, his voice was cold without comfort. "You blasphemy. Resign yourself." Abadando fell back on the pillow. His eyes lost their wild gleam of hope. The nurse came back in the room and started shooing them out in a very matter-of-fact way. The Don got up, but Abadando put out his hand. "Godfather, stay here with me and help me meet death." Yo, this is some fucking shit here. "Stay here with me and help me meet death. Perhaps if Inky sees you near me, he will be frightened and leave me in peace." "Or perhaps you can say a word, pull a few strings, huh?" The dying man winked as if he were mocking the Don. "Now not really serious. Your brothers in blood after all. Then, as if fearing the Don would be offended, he clutched at his hand. "Stay with me. Let me hold your hand. We'll outwit that bastard and we'll outwit it others." Nope, I fucked up. Let's do it again. "Stay with me. Let me hold your hand. We'll outwit that bastard as we outwitted others. Godfather, don't betray me." The Don motioned the other people out the room. They left. He took the withered claw of Ginkgo Abadando in his own two broad hands. Softly reassuring, he comforted his friend as they waited for death together. As if the Don could truly snatch the life out of Ginkgo Abadando back from the most foul and criminal traitor to man.
Dun, 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 dun,
that's a powerful scene right there, yo.
That's right.
That bastard feared death. He knew he had
to. He said, "Nigga, you can't refuse me." He said, "Man, you got to do it. You can't refuse on your wedding day, nigga. You know you can't refuse another Sicilian."
He was really going in and out. From one minute he was begging to the next
that
minute, it's been arranged, huh? Like the Don had betrayed him.
Hell yeah, it's been arranged, huh? So this how I go out? This how you gonna let me go out? Not like this, Tom. Not like this. The wedding day of Connie Corleone ended well for her. Carlo Rizzi performed his duties as a bridegroom with skill and vigor, spurred on by the contents of the bride's gift purse, which totaled up to over $20,000. The bride, however, gave up her virginity with a great deal more willingness than she gave up her purse. Okay? Now, what Candy Burris did. For the latter, she did the opposite. For the latter, he had to blacken one of her eyes. Oh, she wouldn't give up the purse, so he beat her ass.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
he wanted that
19,
money.
That's 1950 money.
It's like,
so
take the pussy, Carlo, but you can't take the purse.
25. How much money is that today? That's probably $200,000.
Yeah, $20,000 is like $2,000 today. I mean, nah, fuck it, $200 in my book.
Mm-hmm.
I spent $20,000 on a pair of shoes.
Right.
Okay, and a burst. And a pack of cigarettes. And a little gas money that's left over for that day. So let's say $200. Today is like $200, $20,000 like
$200. Oh.
In the 90s now, $2,000, $20,000 was like $2,000. Nah, in the 90s, Doc, $20,000. I've had $20,000 in the 90s, motherfucker. It was like $2,000. That shit go fast.
Yeah.
No, we're talking about late, and like she said, what it would be like today. $20,000 in the 40s was like $100,000.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm saying $20,000 today is like $200 a song and $2,000 to others. And $20,000 to poor motherfuckers.
I would agree.
So motherfuckers that's poor as fuck, they like, I got $20,000. To me, $20,000 is like, damn, we're going to be short this month. Like, God damn, we're going to be
right.
short this month. I'm going to have to rob Peter to pay Paul. That was $20,000 to me, goddamn. I'm like, you better get out there. You better get some more hours, motherfucker.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask my mom for some money. Yeah, so this, I know, this is some good shit. Nigga beat her ass for the fucking purse. Lucy Mancini waited in her house for a call from Sonny Corleone, sure that he would ask her out for a date, ask her for a date. Finally, she called his house, and when she heard a woman's voice answer the phone, she hung up. She had no way of knowing that nearly everyone at the wedding had remarked the absence of her and Sonny for that fatal half hour, and the gossip was already spreading that Santino Corleone had found another victim, that he had done the job on his own sister's maid of honor. Amerigo Bonacera had a terrible nightmare. In his dreams, he saw Don Corleone in peak cap, overalls and heavy gloves, unloading bullet-riddled corpses in front of his funeral parlor and shouting, "Remember, Amerigo, not a word to anyone, and bury them quickly." He groaned so loud and long in his sleep that his wife shook him awake. "Eh, what a man you are," she grumbled, "to have a nightmare only after a wedding." Kay Adams, this nigga fucking paranoid, ain't he? Nigga subconscious is straight up fuck with him. Kay Adams was escorted.
He's scared to death.
He more scared of Don Corleone than the goddamn American government.
America, yeah.
Kay Adams was escorted to her New York City hotel by Pauly Gatto and Clemenza. The car was large, luxurious, and driven by Gatto. Clemenza sat in the back seat, and Kay was given the front seat next to the driver. She found both men wildly exotic. Their speech was movie Brooklynese, and they treated her with exaggerated courtliness. During the ride, she chatted casually with both men and was surprised when they spoke of Michael with unmistakable affection and respect. He had led her to believe that he was an alien in his father's world. Now, Clemenza was assuring her in his wheezing, guttural voice that the old man thought Mike was the best of his sons, the one who would surely inherit the family business. "What business is that?" Kay asked in the most natural way. Pauly Gatto gave her a quick glance as he turned the wheel. Behind her, Clemenza said in a surprised voice, "Didn't Mike tell you? Mr. Corleone is the biggest importer of Italian olive oil in the States. Now that the war is over, the business could get real rich. He'll need a smart boy like Mike." At the hotel, Clemenza insisted on coming to the desk with her. When she protested, he said simply, The boss said to make sure you got home okay. I got to do it. After she received her room key, he walked her to the elevator and waited until she got in. She waved to him, smiling, and was surprised at his genuine smile of pleasure in return. It was just as well she did not see him go back to the hotel clerk and ask what name she registered under. The hotel clerk looked at Clemenza coldly. Clemenza rolled the little green spitball he was holding in his hand across to the clerk, who picked it up and immediately said, "Mr. and Mrs. Michael Corleone." Back in the car, Paulie Gatto said, "Nice dame." Clemenza grunted. Mike is doing the job on her. Unless, he thought, they were really married. "Pick me up early in the morning," he told Paulie. "Hagen got some deal for us that got to be done right now, right away." It was late Sunday night. Oh, Neff. Man, how long is this first goddamn chapter, man?
Goddamn.
It was late Sunday night before Tom Hagen could kiss his wife goodbye and drive off to the airport. With his special number one priority, a grateful gift from Pentagon Staff General Officer, he had no trouble getting on a plane to Los Angeles. Y'all heard that shit? Pentagon.
Right.
It had been a busy but satisfying day for Tom Hagen. Ginkgo Abadando had died at 3 in the morning, and when Don Corleone returned from the hospital, he had informed Hagen that he was now officially the new concierge to the family. This meant that Hagen was sure to become a very rich man, to say nothing of power. Don about to come up in the game now, ain't it? The Don had broken a strong-standing tradition. The concierge was always a full-blooded Sicilian, and the fact that Hagen had been brought up as a member of the Don's family made no difference to that tradition. It was a question of blood. Only a Sicilian born to the ways of Omerta, the law of silence, could be trusted in the key post of consigliere. Between the head of the family, Don Corleone, who dictated policy, and the operating level of men who actually carried out the orders of the Don, there were three layers, or buffers. In that way, nothing could be traced to the top, unless the consigliere turned traitor. All right? That Sunday morning, Don Corleone gave explicit instructions on what should be done to the two young men who had beaten the daughter of Amerigo Bonacera. But he had given those orders in private to Tom Hagen. Later in the day, Hagen had, also in private, without witnesses, instructed Clemenza. In turn, Clemenza had told Paulie Gatto to execute the commission. Paulie Gatto would now muster the necessary manpower and execute the orders. Paulie Gatto and his men would not know why this particular task was being carried out or who had ordered it originally. There you go. Each link of the chain would have to turn traitor for the Don to be involved. And though it had never yet happened, there was always the possibility. The cure for that possibility also was known. Only one link in the chain had to disappear. Yeah, they're strong now. Okay, the consigliere was also what his name implied. He was the counselor to the Don, his right-hand man, his auxiliary brain. He was also his closest companion and his closest friend. On important trips, he would drive the Don's car. At conferences, he would go out and get the Don refreshments, coffee and sandwiches, fresh cigars. He would know everything the Don knew, or nearly everything, all the sales of power. He was the one man in the world who could bring the Don crashing down to destruction. But no concierge had ever betrayed a Don, not in the memory of any of the powerful Sicilian families who had established themselves in America. There was no future in it. And every consigliere knew that if he kept the faith, he would become rich. Knew that if he kept the faith, he would become rich, wield power, and win respect. If misfortune came, his wife and children would be sheltered and cared for as if he were alive or free, if he kept the faith. In some matters, the consigliere had to act for his don in a more open way and yet not involve his principal. Hagen was flying to California on just such a matter. He realized that his career as consigliere would be seriously affected by the success or failure of this mission. By family business standards, whether Johnny Fontaine got his coveted part in the war movie or did not was a minor matter. Far more important was the meeting Hagen had set up with Virgil Salazzo the following Friday. But Hagen knew that to the Don, both were of equal importance, which settled the matter for any good consigliere. The piston plane shook Tom Hagen's already nervous inside, and he ordered a martini from the hostess to quiet them. Both the Don and Johnny had briefed him on the character of the movie producer, Jack Waltz. From everything that Johnny said, Hagen knew he would never be able to persuade Waltz. But he also had no doubt whatsoever that the Don would keep his promise to Johnny. His own role was that of a negotiator and contact. Lying back in his seat, Hagen went over all the information given to him that day. Jack Waltz was one of the three most important movie producers in Hollywood, owner of his own studio with dozens of stars under contract. He was of the President of the United States Advisory Council for War Information, Cinematic Division, which meant simply that he helped make propaganda movies. He had dinner at the White House. He had entertained J. Edgar Hoover in his Hollywood home. But none of this was as impressive as it sounded. They were all official relationships. Waltz didn't have any personal political power, mainly because he was an extreme reactionary, partly because he was a megalomaniac who loved to wield power wildly, without regard to the fact that by doing so, legions of enemies sprang up out of the ground. Hagen sighed. There would be no way to handle Jack Waltz. He opened his briefcase, and he tried to get some paperwork done, but he was too tired. I got it. Okay. J1, you got it? I got it. You got it, J1? Okay. Where we at? But he was too tired. Where we at? Where was at? I can't say. I can't find it. Thank you, Vita, for distracting the narrator. He had no regrets, indeed. Nope, but he was too tired. He ordered another martini and reflected on his life. He had no regrets. Indeed, he felt that he had been extremely lucky. Whatever the reason, the course he had chosen 10 years ago had proved to be right for him. He was successful. He was as happy as any grown man could reasonably expect, and he found life interesting. Tom Hagen was 35 years old, a tall, crew-cut man, very slender, very ordinary looking. He was a lawyer, but did not do the actual detailed legal work for the Corleone family business, though he had practiced law for 3 years after passing the bar exam. At the age of 11, he had been a playmate of 11-year-old Sonny Corleone. Hagen's mother had gone blind and then died during his 11th year. Hagen's father, a heavy drinker, had become a hopeless drunkard. A hard-working carpenter, he had never done a dishonest thing in his life, but his drinking destroyed his family and finally killed him. Tom Hagen was left an orphan who wandered the streets and slept in hallways. His younger sister had been put in a foster home, but in the 1920s, the social agencies did not follow up cases of 11-year-old boys who were so ungrateful as to run from their charity. Hagen, too had an eye infection. Neighbors whispered that he had caught and inherited. He had caught or inherited it from his mother, and so therefore it could be caught from him. He was Sean. Sonny Corleone, a warm-hearted and imperious 11-year-old, had brought his friend home and demanded that he be taken in. Tom Hagen was given a hot dish of spaghetti with oily-rich tomato sauce, the taste of which he had never forgotten, and then given a metal folding bed to sleep on. In the most natural way, without a word being spoken or the matter discussed in any fashion, Don Corleone had permitted the boy to stay in his household. Don Corleone himself took the boy to a special doctor and had his eye infection cured. He sent him to college and law school. In all this, the Don acted not as a father, but rather as a guardian. There was no show of affection, but oddly enough, the Don treated Hagen more courteously than his own sons, did not impose a parental will upon him. He did not impose a parental will upon him. It was the boy's decision to go to law school after college. He had heard Don Corleone say once, a lawyer with his briefcase can steal more than 100 men with guns. Ooh, that's why I'm going to be a lawyer. Meanwhile, much to the annoyance of their father, Sonny and Freddie insisted on going into the family business after graduation from high school. Only Michael had gone on to college, and he had enlisted in the Marines the day after Pearl Harbor. After he passed the bar exam, Hagen married to start his own family. The bride was a young Italian girl from New Jersey, rare at that time for being a college graduate. After the wedding, which was, of course, held in the home of Don Corleone, the Don offered to support Hagen in any undertaking he desired, to send him law clients, furnish his office, start him in real estate. Tom Hagen had bowed his head and said to the Don, I would like to work for you. The Don was surprised, yet pleased. You know who I am? He asked. Hagen nodded. He hadn't really known the extent of the Don's power, not then. He did not really know in the 10 years that followed until he was made the acting consigliere after Ginkgo Abadando became ill. But he nodded and met the Don's eyes with his own. I would work for you like your sons, Hagen said, meaning with complete loyalty, with complete acceptance of the Don's parental divinity. The Don, with that understanding, which was even then building the legend of his greatness, showed the young man the first mark of fatherly affection since he had come into his household. He took Hagen into his arms for a quick embrace and afterward treated him more like a true son, though he would sometimes say, Tom, never forget your parents, as if he were reminding himself as well as Hagen. There was no chance that Hagen would forget. His mother had been near moronic and slovenly, so ridden by anemia, she could not feel affection for her children or make a pretense of it. His father, Hagen, had hated. His mother's blindness before she died had terrified him, and his own eye infection had been a stroke of doom. He had been sure he would go blind. When his father died, Tom Hagen's 11-year-old mind had snapped in a curious way. He had roamed the streets like an animal waiting for death until the fateful day Sonny found him sleeping in the back of a hallway and brought him to his home. What had happened afterward was a miracle. But for years, Hagen had nightmares, dreaming he had grown to manhood blind. Tapping a white cane, his blind children behind him tapping with their little white canes as they begged in the streets. Some mornings when he woke, the face of Don Corleone was imprinted on his brain in the first conscious moment, and he would feel safe. But the Don had insisted that he put in 3 years of general law practice in addition to his duties for the family business. This experience had proved invaluable later on and also removed any doubts in Hagen's mind about working for Don Corleone. He had then spent 2 years of training in the offices of a top firm of criminal lawyers in which the Don had some influence. It was apparent to everyone that he had a flair for this branch of the law. He did well, and when he went into the full-time service of the family business, Don Corleone had been able to reproach him once in the 6 years that followed. When he had been made the acting consigliere, the other powerful Sicilian families referred contemptuously to the Corleone family as the Irish gang. This had amused Hagen. It had also taught him that he could never hope to succeed the Don as the head of the family business, but he was content. That had never been his goal. Such an ambition would have been a disrespect to his benefactor and his benefactor's blood family. We'll stop there. You want to stop there?
Yeah,
we got to stop there. We got 5 minutes.
That's it for tonight. Great job, Don. Great job.
Thank you. I tried. I did my best.
Excellent read, Don.
So now we see who Tom Hagen was and why he had loyalty to the family, because they literally saved his life. So no matter what, he saw the Don
right.
as his savior.
Savior, now, exactly.
Father, yeah.
True loyalty. You didn't have to worry about old Tom. Tom was going to be there. That's what happened with somebody like those who save your life, stuff like that. That's that real loyalty. It's hard to find these days. You know, he said even though that Irish gang thought even just crossed his mind, he thought that was cute, but he didn't even let that go to his head, you know, because some people would let that shit go to their head, like, I'm about to be this shit. I'm about to be that one. Yeah, I always like Tom Hagen's character in the movie.
Don, you see where I get, I say everybody go out and get, once you've gone to college, go out and spend no more than 5 years learning what you have to learn. I got that straight out of The Godfather.
Mm.
And it says here that Tom only went 3 years.
Right. And she stepped away just for a moment, Violinus.
Yeah.
Mhm.
So that's where I got that idea from.
Say it again for the people.
Once you go, if you go to get a skill, a trade,
mm-hmm.
you go to college, whatever it is, whatever area you want to go to, I said you can look at working for somebody else for no more than 5 years.
Right.
You learn everything you need to know during that time. So you literally make yourself invaluable.
Mm-hmm. True apprenticeship.
Yeah.
True apprenticeship. Learning
right.
the whole in business, the in and
own.
Out workings. That's right.
Right.
Because
you
right.
need that. You need that background. And you also need that to be able to build that expertise.
That's right. That's right. Whatever it is you do. That's right, an exact Violinus. That was a good read. Oh, man. Looking forward to it. I think we're only midway through, right? Midway through the first chapter?
Almost. I think the first chapter ends on 52.
Okay.
So we're on page 41. So we
okay.
almost made it through the
yeah,
first
we'll
chapter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is a long book.
Right. Man, that opening scene is a classic, man. The wedding, all the characters getting introduced. That is a classic scene. It really is.
Yeah.
This is a first for me. I've always seen Mario Puzo's book, but I never picked it up and read it. So this is a first for me. But I got that movie. I've seen the movie 1,000 times. So this is good. We get to see the intricacies. Because they never really showed the first concierge in part one.
In part one. But you know that he's the guy who had the business with him in when Robert De Niro
The olive
was he the one
business?
Who tossed him the guns? I don't think that was the one who tossed him the guns and got him robbing at first. That wasn't him. Right?
No, no. He's the one that they started the olive oil business together.
That was Fish.
No, no, the olive oil business. Remember he was
Yeah, I know the olive oil business.
It was called Ginkgo. It was called Ginkgo in the movie. Yeah, that's
he
Ginkgo
was working for
Alabama.
His father. And his father lets him go. I think that's Ginkgo's
Oh,
father.
That's not a, that was a, no, that was like a sandwich shop or a butcher shop. Like a, he had a, that wasn't
that was
no Ginkgo. Olive oil company. Okay, that was him?
Yeah, it was
father.
Ginkgo oil or some old shit. Ginkgo olive
oh,
some old shit.
And his girlfriend was the actress.
Yes.
That the black hand was.
That's Ginkgo.
Gotcha.
That's Ginkgo.
Okay.
That's him.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they go off and start the olive oil business, which is really a cover.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, that was his girlfriend was the actress, and the black hand went on and strong-armed him.
Right, right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Can I just make one correction? Olive mm-hmm. oil business is not a cover. That was a real fucking business. Okay? Well,
that
even
was
though
the
we never
business.
Saw the fucking olive oil.
No,
it was,
we saw the olive oil in part two.
As in, we never saw that fucking olive. We saw a truck. Well, that
no,
was
we saw
olive
part
oil
two.
In it.
When he went to the old-ass Don... In Sicily, and he gave him a bottle. He said, "This is my family's olive oil." And
yeah,
he shanked his ass.
It was real business, but it wasn't the business.
It was the laundering money business.
Probably, yeah.
See, the gangster part of it was that they was making all the stores carry their olive oil. That's where the gangster part comes in at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you going to put our fucking shit in your goddamn store, we're going to blow your fucking brains out, motherfucker.
Right.
Now get these goddamn cases.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't want to see nobody olive oil on your goddamn shelf but ours.
Yeah, probably.
We'll blow your fucking brains out. Make your wife a widow. Make your son a bastard.
Starting the union with the truckers. Yeah, probably starting the union with the truckers and getting the money out of the union, the whole nine yards. It just blossom.
Okay, well, the Italian woman about to cut y'all off. Y'all, you know, let's get the last little words. And let's get
All right,
about it.
Well, thank you so much, Don. Can't wait till next week so we can get to read some more. Thank you, Neff, and I appreciate everybody. I hope y'all are enjoying the book.
Yes. And we're going to be on page 41 of my next week, the bottom of 41, so somebody can remind the nigga just in case.
I can hear Doc in the background. You enjoying it, Doc?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, of course he did. Nigga traveled all the way from Africa to come sit in my goddamn face. We about to get cut off, though. Let's go. We out of here. Good night, y'all.
Peace, y'all.
You